Good morning. I am currently a postdoc at Baylor College of Medicine, and I'm going to tell you a bit about work I've been doing on form recognition recording in monkeys, and specifically area infratemporal cortex, and I'll tell you all about that. So I was hoping this would be kind of informal, and I noticed from our earlier discussions that lots of people had questions about exactly how you get this data, what are the animals doing, and so forth. So I think it would probably benefit a lot of you if you would stop me and say, could you explain that more clearly, and so forth. And I think we have plenty of time, because if you didn't stop me at all, this would be a little over an hour, hour and 15 minutes or so. So we have plenty of time. So please feel free to interrupt at any point, and so forth. So, as I said, I'm interested in visual object recognition, so this relates very closely to what Tommy was talking about. And this next slide I like to use to illustrate some of the reasons that I find recognition to be very fascinating. Would you prefer if I move this over here? Okay. I don't want to block your views. So, if you could just watch the screen. Okay, so... Those images were flashed pretty quickly, but I think that most of you could identify three different objects in those three images at least. There was a car, a picture of Bill Clinton, someone got it, and there was a picture of a Dalmatian. And so this illustrates some things about recognition that we find.
Can you flash again?
Sure, let me give it another shot here.
But now it's low.
Yeah. Now I've already primed those representations. Anybody want to see it again? Okay.
That's a great
name,
Dalmatian.
It's a Dalmatian. It's actually my dog, so I'd like to get that little input there. So some of the things it illustrates about recognition that lots of us working in this field find fascinating is that we're very good at it, as I think most of you identify those images, and it happens very quickly. Those images were flashed at about a rate of 3 per second. You can do recognition of flashed images detecting an object or a scene in a series of images at rates of up to about 10 images per second. And the other thing that you may or may not be aware of is that you're very good at identifying those objects regardless of things like their exact position, their exact size, the illumination conditions, the view of the object, the things that Tommy was talking about in his talk, the so-called the things that you seem to be invariant to in your recognition abilities. And this is really the difficult problem of recognition, and I'll try to discuss that a bit more later on and show you some data on at least one aspect of that, in particular position invariance. So again, for me, the central question is, how does the brain actually do this process, which I find remarkable? And some of the issues that come up in this kind of work, just to lay out for you, are that first the issue of representation. So images are first represented in the pattern of firing, one of the first representations is the pattern of firing in the retinal ganglion cells in the back of your retina. So you can think of that as almost a pixel-based representation of the world. But eventually they get transformed to some higher-level brain representations. We call this high-level representation. And we don't know the form of that representation, but we think understanding that form is critical to understanding recognition. The other thing that comes up in studies of recognition is the issue of long-term memory. So for you to recognize objects, of course, requires some previous experience with those objects, somebody telling you that's a Dalmatian, in other words, assigning an appropriate name to the object. And in some models, these are viewed as distinct processes, but for many of you working in neural networks, and I take this view myself as well, if you have a large, say, feed-forward neural network, then representation and memory are essentially intertwined and are essentially two sides of the same coin. You're having changes in the network, and those are changing both the representation, and those essentially are forming the memories of objects. And the last issue I'd like to bring up that I'm not going to discuss at all, but I just like to always kick out there, is the issue of reverse engineering. So as I pointed out, we're very good at this. Machines are not so good at this. And I still hold out hope that with lots of us working on this problem, that someday we'll be able to improve the way machines are actually able to do vision or object recognition in particular. So let me give you an overview of the things I was going to discuss. First, I'll talk a bit more about the recognition problem and how I framed it. Then I'll talk about the brain regions that are likely to be involved. Tommy already introduced some of this, so it might be a review, but I'll show you a little bit of the background data and why we think those regions are involved. In particular, I'm going to be focused on an area called the infratemporal cortex, which you've already heard about. Then I'll discuss essentially how we study infratemporal cortex, or how we study IT, how we study the neuronal responses there. And then I'm going to tell you about some data that I've collected in the last, as I said, 2 or 3 years on two particular issues. And one is the effect of free viewing on IT responses, that is, on the IT representation. And I'll introduce this more clearly when we get there, but the basic idea is that when you perform recognition, you don't hold your eyes perfectly still. You're constantly scanning scenes and so forth. And you're still able to perform recognition even in the context of eye movements several times per second. The last thing that I'll discuss relates to this kind of key issue in recognition, which is the issue of invariance. And I'll show you some data that we've collected on position invariance in IT. Okay, so now I'll start with an introduction to the recognition problem. The way I like to think of this problem is, I think, similar to what Tommy introduced to you. Essentially, it's an identification problem, or it's a mapping, if you will. So what happens sometime during your life, you are told or instructed that these particular images should be mapped to these responses when you're asked to identify them. So for instance, when you see this image or this object, you say A. When you see that one, you say B, and so forth. So it's simply a mapping. Now, I should point out that recognition can be based on many aspects of the visual scene, but the cues that I'm going to focus on today and the cues that are shown here, the most important one is what we call shape. But there are other cues that can identify objects, things like motion, texture, and color. And also, the location of an object in a scene relative to other objects can help as a cue to identify the object. But we'll be focused on shape today. So this is another view of what the recognition problem is. This is the first time I've presented this slide, so you can tell me what you think. It's just to give you an idea that what we have is some points in stimulus space, which are, say, those four objects I just showed you, and the object, or the goal of the task, is to map those regions of stimulus space to appropriate regions of some response space. So in this case, say, motor outputs for the vocalization of those four responses, or any number of responses that you could come up with. And again, by way of introduction, the problem with this, you might say, well, I can just draw little circles around those regions of stimulus space and I've solved the problem. Well, of course, you want to be able to identify objects regardless of the things that Tommy talked about, things like position and size and orientation. So here I've illustrated a size change. And what happens is, in the initial pixel space, as you change the size of an object, you move it very far away from where it started in a pure Euclidean distance sense. So you actually move it, some transformations will move it further away from its starting point than, say, a change in identity. So you have to solve this problem, you really have to come up with a warped mapping on the initial stimulus space to do the problem in the way that we'd like to do it. That is, to be invariant to all these things, like position and size in this case. So that's kind of a computational just overview or outline of the problem. But being a neurophysiologist and an experimentalist, the question again is, how does the brain do this? And this raises two issues. So first of all, I've implied that we're all very good at this, we can do this mapping, but there is an issue of really, how good are we at this? How invariant are we? And we have this perception that we are very invariant, but this has to be tested, and this is tested by psychophysicists. So this is part of the study. Part of the research is to do psychophysics in both humans and monkeys to identify how invariant we are to various changes in the image. And then, especially for my work, the issue is then mechanism. Okay, so the psychophysicist views this as a black box, and you have an input-output mapping, but the nice thing about neurophysiology is that we can go into these different areas, look at the neural responses, and then therefore try to infer the mechanism that this mapping, the mechanism that underlies this mapping. So that's essentially My goal is to understand those mechanisms, and as I said in the introduction, that is to understand the neural representations that support a transformation from this stimulus space to that response space. So, any questions so far before I go on to the next section? Okay, so now I'll tell you about the brain regions that we think are likely to be involved in the problem. And I think Tommy had a slide similar to this one. A lot of work over the last century really have identified regions of the brain, and then what I've shown here are just visual regions of the visual cortex of the brain. And of course, what happens is, and I don't have this on my slide, but Tommy did, the information flows into the retina, which is of course sitting up here. This is the front, this is the back, and it goes through the thalamus, the lateral geniculate nucleus, and then arrives in primary area V1. From there are two major processing pathways, and these shouldn't be viewed as completely distinct. There are interconnections between these pathways, but this is kind of a rough overview for the way we think about how information is processed in the brain. And the pathways are, the first one is called the parietal pathway, or sometimes referred to as the where pathway. This is thought to be involved in identifying the location of objects, or the relative location of some objects relative to others. The second pathway, which we'll be more focused on, is called the temporal pathway, involved in identifying what is the object. So you can see this is important for recognition. This is essentially the recognition problem. And it goes along the ventral part of the brain. It's sometimes called the ventral pathway. That is, it goes into the temporal lobe, hence the name temporal pathway. And it, again, thought to be identified in identifying what is the object. So one of the reasons that we think this pathway is involved in object identification or object recognition is that lesions to this part of the brain disrupt object recognition. That and neurons in this part of the brain, as I'll show you, can have very specific selectivity to highly complex objects, things like faces, or you saw the example from Nikos Logothetis' lab that Tommy showed you with those complex paperclip objects, and I'll show you some other examples. Also, the receptive fields of neurons tend to get bigger as you go from V1 to anterior infratemporal cortex. And this could underlie some position in size invariance, and that will be the focus of the second part of my talk. So what I've shown over here are the Fehlman and Van Essen, or really condensed Fehlman and Van Essen. Tommy showed you a similar diagram of the cortical areas that I've roughly described here. At the bottom we have area V1, and then so for the temporal pathway, information flows from area V1 to V2 to V4 and on into the so-called infratemporal cortices, which have been divided in various ways, and I think we discussed this. There aren't clean, say, walls between them as these lines would imply, but essentially they're divided into thirds, posterior central and anterior infratemporal cortex, and roughly speaking, stimulus selectivity gets more and more complex as you move along this pathway. And the data that I'll tell you about today all came from an area called anterior infratemporal cortex, the same area that Tommy showed you data from Nikos Logothetis.
This diagram is PFC, prefrontal cortex, would be between?
It would be up here, and there are projections from anterior IT to prefrontal. So prefrontal on this map is, for those of you who don't know, is in this area here. And I think I actually have maybe something that will help you on the next slide. I have the outputs from IT.
Yeah.
Okay, so again, for those of you who don't know IT so well, this is just some statistics I put up on it. It's about a total of about 8 square centimeters in the monkey brain. That's about 8% of its total neocortex, or about 15% of its visual cortex. So you can see from these numbers that monkeys are very visual animals. About half of their cortex is devoted to visual processing. And within the total in IT in both hemispheres, there are about 90 million neurons, to give you a sense of the numbers we're facing. And again, it's been divided into various subregions, and I've just listed the two major schemes that you might see if you read about this area. The posterior, central, and anterior, which is the Fehlman and Van Essen scheme that I tend to use. And there's also a scheme where the posterior half is called TEO and the anterior is called TE. And just so you're aware that all these are describing essentially the same part of the brain that I showed you.
Just for a comparison, V1 is
Total area of V1 is, I think it's about twice this size. So it's, V1 is, I think about 30% of visual cortex. I don't know the exact number.
When is the brainstem viewed to?
Okay, so yeah, so then I was about, so the inputs and outputs, so can I just hold that for a second? So the major cortical inputs and outputs, which are, I've kind of already described for you, again, flow from V1 to V2 to V4, and then on into infratemporal cortex. Within infratemporal cortex, there are projections from posterior to anterior, central to anterior. So everything's kind of flowing forward, and that's what these yellow arrows indicate. There are also, I think as Tommy pointed out as well, although we focus on the feed-forward connections, there are strong feedback projections from all of these areas. So IT projects back towards V4, and of course V4 back to V2, and so on. The outputs of IT go to many different cortical areas. Tommy just mentioned prefrontal cortex, which is thought to be involved in kind of task control, and areas like the frontal eye field, which might be important in our task because we require motor outputs, saccade outputs, movements of the eyes. And this area of cortex is thought to be involved in controlling voluntary eye movements. An area, of course, the parietal cortex, which is actually part of the Wear pathway I showed you earlier. And then projections go to even deeper into the brain, if you will, to the perirhinal cortex and perihippocampal cortex, which have connections to the entorhinal cortex and then the hippocampus, which many of you know has been involved or actively researched as an important site in memory consolidation, and also to the amygdala. Now, okay, so for the subcortical inputs and outputs, IT does have projections to the striatum, which we heard about yesterday, and also projections to parts of the thalamus, and it does receive inputs from the thalamus and the hypothalamus, and also these diffuse inputs from the brainstem, which almost all cortical areas receive, which are thought to be neuromodulatory in terms of activation or arousal of the cortex, but nobody knows the details of these, but the circuits are thought not to be detailed enough to do, say, form processing, but more general activation of regions of the brain. So I don't know if that answers your question, but those are the major inputs and outputs from that.
When we compare the idea of monkeys to the idea of humans, what should we understand? The idea of humans, or temporal lobe of humans, contains more areas, or does it contain the same, does it contain higher brain areas than this, like processing of monkeys thought at some point?
Right. All right, that's a great question, because here, so I neglected to say this, but the monkey, you see, you're kind of running out of brain here, and this isn't visual, this is, you know, somatosensory and things, so this is kind of the end of the visual pathway, the rest of this, so those memory areas and visual and motor areas. So, but if you look at the same map in humans, first of all, we don't know exactly what the homology is between, say, anterior infratemporal cortex in the monkey and anterior infratemporal cortex in the human, although we're starting to make inroads on that due to the fMRI work that's been done. But so humans have an interesting deficit called prosopagnosia, which many of you may have heard of, which is the inability to recognize specific faces, that is, specific complex objects. And lesion data from those patients show that it's, if you were going to make this a human brain, and this is the occipital lobe, and of course it's bigger and more folds, but that region is actually sits back here near the junction of the temporal lobe and the occipital lobe in humans. So there's a whole bunch of brain still up in front of the human that doesn't actually exist in the monkey. And if you've seen maps, so say V1 and V4 in the human from fMRI studies, again, the same thing. Everything is kind of compressed back this way. And so there is a lot of brain out there from humans that probably won't map clearly to any of these monkey areas, probably involved in things like language. But we believe because there are face-specific responses in monkey cortex, as you saw, that there, and as far as anterior infratemporal cortex, there is a human homolog, but it hasn't been exactly defined yet. But so we think our studies are still relevant to human recognition. But when it comes to study things like that are very specific to humans, like language, of course, the monkey's not going to be a very good model for that and may lack the brain structures that humans have evolved to have.
You said that 50% of the monkey's brain is visual. So what percentage of humans is visual?
I think it's a little less than that. I don't want to give you a number and send you off the wrong, but I think it's, maybe Tommy knows offhand, but it's between 30 and 50%. It's still a large percentage of the brain.
That's the neocortex.
Neocortex, right. I mean, because part of the problem is, how do you define what's visual? So as I said, this might all be visual in the human, but then you've got this whole temporal lobe, which is getting more into things like language, and maybe that's not so visual, but again, it's not going to be a wall of visual, not visual. So even that, even here, the 50% number is a kind of rough ballpark of, you know, you get visual responses in about 50% of the brain is one way to think about it, but it doesn't mean there aren't, say, somatosensory inputs, the interior infratemporal cortex, and so forth. So none of these areas are strictly visual or not, it's just a rough estimate of areas that have visual responses.
Related to this, in the prefrontal cortex, do you also have visual responses?
Yes.
So why
yes.
Don't you put
it? Well, so that's what I mean. It's somewhat arbitrary because you can get, it's thought to be more involved in task control than, but I mean, task control ultimately depends on having some sort of input. So ultimately, everything depends on inputs from
but
somewhere.
In terms of the responses, it's no less visual than the brain.
Yeah, I guess it would depend on the way. So I'm not an expert on prefrontal cortex, but there are parts of prefrontal which might be more somatosensory than visual, and so it's more of a mixture of areas. A lot of areas converge on the prefrontal cortex, so that's it's partly the anatomy that defines that.
Also for the prefrontal cortex.
Yes. Right, and so they're strongly interconnected, and you get lots of convergence from the somatosensory and the visual in this region, and from here and the somatosensory into the prefrontal.
How well is that? Should I view that as a cartoon, or should I view that as a well-established connectivity diagram?
The connectivity is well established. It's mostly through injecting tracers and following where they go into different areas. But as I pointed out, say for the divisions here, that's not clearly established. But the general feed-forward flow is well established. And it is, so for instance, it's never going to turn out that V1 isn't connected to V2. I mean, that's known with certainty, and V2 to V4 and V4 to IT. Now, the details and how strong these connections are, this diagram essentially implies something about the strength of connections, and actually the connections are stronger this way, but there are interconnections. But stronger is usually inferred by things like numbers of connections and density of tracer that you'd find after injection. So it could be that it's hard to assess exactly how strong all those wiring diagrams are.
This is time delays between.
So time delay. So V1, you know, there's a range of latencies, that neural latencies that you measure in V1. This is to spiking latency. V1 would be in the range of, you know, 50 to 60 millisecond latencies, and in IT you're looking at 100 to 150, and these are kind of intermediate latencies. So there seems to be a progression of latencies through these areas here. I'm not as familiar with the latency data on this area, but I think it follows the same trend, which is all consistent with this kind of feed-forward flow of activity.
And also, I think the division between the area is pretty clear for the first two ones, because they are strongly retinotopic. But as you go higher up,
right,
it's a bit more fuzzy, whether merit or another one, right?
That's exactly right. Yeah, and I should have said that. And there actually are anatomical distinctions between some of these areas and MT. There are some anatomical markers for these. So that, you know, even I said the walls aren't well defined. Some of these areas they actually are. It's just these higher ones where things just get fuzzy. And I think they'll always be to some extent fuzzy, because all of our memories are different. And so it's not clear that we're all going to have the same layout of things in this area. And so you become an expert in, say, bird watching, that maybe you develop sets of neurons that are different than someone else would develop. You'd have to. There's no other way to explain your ability, how you're able to do that. And so we're talking about areas that are, as I pointed out at the beginning, involved in both representation and memory. So they probably get pushed around a lot, if you will, and there aren't some clear distinctions between those areas. At least that's my personal viewpoint. Okay, so let me show you a little of the data of why we're even in IT, why we think all those things about it's the what pathway. And I mentioned the lesion studies disrupt recognition, but there are also the neurophysiological studies which suggest very strong selectivity. Now, IT was first studied with a single extracellular electrodes by Charlie Gross in the late 1960s. Desimone was in Gross's lab for some time, and this is a study from Desimone, Gross, Albright, K. can't remember the last author, 1984. And again, this is some of the initial work on exploring selectivity in IT. And this is an anesthetized monkey. And so what I'm showing here, each of these top rows is a spike raster, as you saw, and not a spike raster, a spike histogram, as you saw in Tommy's presentation. The little bars underneath here indicate the time that the stimulus is on. So you can't read this, but this is about 10 seconds the stimulus would be on. So what would happen is they have this anesthetized monkey, the eyes are held open, it's looking at a screen, and an object will come up on the screen, and it would sit there for 10 seconds, and they'd record the neural responses, and then the object would disappear. Average over many trials, and this is what you get. So these are the different objects. This is an example of one neuron in infratemporal cortex showing selectivity for hands in this case. So this neuron responds very well to these hands. You can see these nice responses here. Not so well to this small hand getting weaker, but hardly little response to this glove. And then they use these kind of broken up versions of a hand or this kind of box-shaped cartoon of a hand, and they didn't get any response from that apparently, or a different size. And this, they tested a face here and something that has a similar orientation, like maybe it was just a V1 neuron and preferred this orientation. And so these kind of controls show that this neuron really has some selectivity for something that's not so simple.
Are they showing them the black and white cartoon drawing of the hand, or are they showing them the real hand? Are they being shown a three-dimensional object that is a lab assistant holding up the monkey hand?
So every lab does things differently, and I can't recall the details of this study. I think they were probably black and white objects, probably line-drawn objects just like are shown here. This is copied out of their paper. I'd have to go back and check. But some labs have used more 3D objects. Some labs have actually held objects on fishing poles, essentially, in front of the animals. Of course, the problem there is you don't have a lot of control over how long it is and the time and latencies and things like that. But all of these things have been done, and they've gotten more and more sophisticated. These are kind of the early studies where they were just showing, look, things can be very selective. That's why I was putting this up. But nowadays, people use, say, 3D objects like you saw from Nikos's lab with the paperclip, that are actually computer-generated objects on a screen from any view, rather than, say, handheld things or just something flashed in front of the animal.
So these cells classify objects, right? They say they respond to heads, but not to heads. Was there ever seen a neuron which actually identifies objects, like responds to one thing, but not to another?
I missed the last two words.
If there was ever found a neuron which would distinguish, let's say, one face from another, or one hand from another, and not just two faces.
So there are, of course, neurons. This was just one example. They, in the same paper, showed neurons that were sensitive to faces and seemed to be particularly sensitive to certain views of faces.
Yeah.
But they didn't test in detail, you know, what's the discriminability.
I'm asking not about this.
Right. But so there's a question of how finely you can discriminate this. There was a study by Young and Yamani with a bunch of faces and showed that among their neural population that they recorded, you know, 50 or 100 neurons, and that they could distinguish among five or six faces among members of the lab, and they were well distinguished in that population space. And so this is something that should be pointed out, that it's not clear what the code is, especially for things like faces. It may be a population code, that is, the pattern of firing across neurons, rather than a single neuron saying, yes, it's Joe or it's Sally, right? So it's more, as I think, as Tommy was pointing out, for objects like faces, you may have a more distributed code for faces. But for things like those paper clips, it could be that you've got a more of a sparse code that neurons have actually been tuned up for particular complex objects.
Faces, I think, there is this Yamani Young study, but there is anecdotal evidence from some people, like Dave Parent, of some cells that respond strongly to one face,
and less viewpoint.
One specific face and one viewpoint, and less to others. Yeah, but you know, as far as I know, there was no quantitative extent, because you have to test against a lot of distractors, mm-hmm. towards other faces, in order to be able.
Yeah, but he didn't respond to all faces.
They had this nice picture, like 20 faces or so, to respond only to one. I remember this picture, but it was anecdotal.
And there is this other story, which I think that's even more anecdotal, of Christoph Koch and Itzhak Fried. They recorded from humans, and they have a cell that responds only to Bill Clinton.
any viewpoint.
Okay, so I mean, this is part of the issue. This, all of these are great questions, but it, the data, it's not known. So that's kind of where the experimentalists are supposed to improve things. I think we slowly are. This is another, to give you an example, this is actually a neuron that seemed to like a monkey face. This is from Kobitaki, which is in Tanaka's lab in Japan. This is now in 1994. And they have a nice series of studies where they'd find neurons that seem to be selective like this, but then they'd really try to make an effort to reduce it to what are the critical features of the stimulus that are driving the neuron. Now, of course, the space is huge, is how do you reduce this to finding what are the critical features? And they kind of explored the obvious dimensions, but this was all mostly done by hand. So they'd say, well, let's try something that's kind of a face shape here, and we still get a good response. Well, if we take away the mouth, it goes away. Take away the eyes, it goes across, it goes away. Now we take away this outline, it seems to go away. Now it's just a circle. And they come back to the face, and it's back again, and it doesn't like it if the eyes and the mouth aren't black. So it seems to be that there are, this neuron is giving you more hints that this is something, it's something complex about these objects. Some holistic configuration of features is generally the words that are used. Not something simple like, well, it liked an oriented mouth here or something like that, like a V1 neuron might do. All right, so if you didn't do this and I just showed you this and you had a V1 neuron, you could get, you know, nice response to that and maybe not some other object like some of the, well, not these, but I think you see the point that there has to be some work to show that it's selective for complex configurations of stimuli. And that's, they've taken some steps in that direction.
Move around the electrode and look at nearby neurons. What are they doing?
So actually that's a good question, because in this same lab they did essentially that. They tried to map different regions of IT, so they make penetrations through cortex across that big large expanse of IT. And as you may know, cortex seems to be vertically organized, so that neurons in a vertical column of cortex tend to have similar response properties. And their data suggested that that was roughly true for IT, so if they were going vertically through cortex and IT, they would see similar responses. So in this case, I would imagine they'd get something that tended to like faces. But then if they moved horizontally in any direction, they'd find other things. And they've actually presented data where they show maps of, well, these liked stars and these liked faces, and you know, they have a big array of features that they tested, and they like to think that that's the alphabet that's represented in IT. But of course, the way they arrived at this alphabet is to kind of arbitrarily probe stimulus space, and it's not clear how well they've explored that space. But I think the thing from their data that is probably true is this, that you said move the electrodes. If you move the electrode up and down, things tend to not change so much, but that's not strictly true. Nothing seems to be strictly true in the brain. And if you move horizontally, things will change more in terms of the selectivity. But exactly what are the basis functions, what are the neurons tuned for in those different columns, that still remains to be worked out. Does that answer the question? Well, so they did a little of that. Again, this is kind of anecdotal as well, and I'll get to that at the end, but they'd move it around a bit, a few degrees, and they'd find usually that the response would weaken, but it'd still be selective and it would still be present. So in some sense, they were invariant to things like relatively large size changes, which I'll show you, and also position changes, and also some size changes. But this has only, again, even less exploration. They were focused mainly on the stimulus space. They did a little bit of exploration of that space as well. But usually the numbers are, you just say, we looked at 20 neurons and we moved it around and we saw only a 50% reduction in response over 5 degrees, and the neuron was still selective. So there is evidence that some neurons are somewhat invariant, but it hasn't been well quantified yet.
The spike rates are about, I can't read that, 50 spikes per second?
Or right, so this one is 50 spikes per second to the top of this bar. And that's about typical for a very nicely responsive IT neuron.
So they look at translation, let's see, Tanaka spikes between what, 3 and 7 degrees?
Something like that, with about 3 to 5 degree size stimuli,
3 to 5 degrees,
which is, I think, about what these are. I have a little bit of that data at the end. I can show you, not from this group,
yeah.
But Okay.
This is Tanaka, right?
This is a Tanaka group. Okay, so that was just to, again, introduce you to why we even think IT is an important area, that you've got neural selectivity. We'll get on to invariance at the end that kind of came up here. Now I'll talk about, finally, some of the things that we've been doing and how we've been studying IT, and hopefully it will make sense in the context of what I've just shown you. So we essentially wanted to get monkeys. I should point out, all of the data I showed you was either in anesthetized animals or passively viewing animals. Okay, so there are known to be lots of state effects in the brain, things like attention can modulate responses. These effects get stronger the further along that processing chain you go, which makes a lot of sense. But so then you start to ask the question, well, would these responses be changed if you actually put animals in a recognition task? In other words, turn the system on, right, rather than just study it in an anesthetized or passively viewing mode. So there have been some studies now, again, the Logothetis study I keep coming back to, is some of the best studies on these kind of issues. But we wanted to get our animals actually performing a recognition task and then record the data on things like invariance and free viewing, which I'll show you. And so I essentially train an animal to do a task just like those four letters that I showed you earlier. I said, well, let's have it learn four target stimuli that are similar to each other. And the way I taught, or the animal signaled that they knew the stimuli, was that they'd stare at a screen like this. So the animal's head is fixed. They have an implanted head post on their skull. They're well conditioned to this. So they come down, sit in the room. They sit in a chair with their head fixed, and they stare at the screen. They have a juice tube in their mouth. They are happily perform this task thousands of trials a day for juice reward. And this is kind of what they would see. So the animal would be staring at a gray screen like this. These four white squares are always illuminated in the corners. Those are what I will refer to as response locations. And then what we do is present objects in various ways, which I'll explain to you. One of those four objects, and the animal's job was to identify the object. And the way it did it was, so for instance, if it saw this object, its appropriate response was to make an eye movement to this response location. So this is just like that mapping I laid out for you at the beginning. Instead of vocalizations, we're using eye movements. Okay, it's still a motor response, still a sensory to motor mapping. Similarly, for this other object, it would make this saccade. And for this object, this saccade. And this object, this saccade. Okay, four objects, four response locations. It's a one-to-one mapping, and we never change this for the animal, just like we don't change the letters of the alphabet around on you. Okay, so they learn this very quickly. And that's actually some of the advantages of this recognition task relative to some other tasks that have been used to study IT, that it requires a relatively short training time, about 1 to 2 months. And the other tasks require animals to train for 6 months to a year or more, which you can see can be very costly experimentally. The other things that advantages of this task that I'd like to point out is that it's what I call a pure recognition task, and that it is a stimulus to response mapping, as I defined it at the beginning, rather than, say, something like a delayed match to sample. So the other advantage is that because of this stimulus to response mapping, we let the animals go as quickly as they like. I'll show you this in a moment. That is, as soon as they identify the object, they can make that response as soon as they're ready. And they tend to go quite quickly, in about 250 milliseconds. I'll show you that in a moment as well. This creates a short, physiologically meaningful time window for looking at the neural responses. That is, we know what point in time the brain activity must relate to this response, rather than studying the monkey with the animal staring at the object for a second or more, and then wouldn't know which portion of the neural response the animal might be extracting to drive its behavior. This way, we essentially constrain the region to look for the neural responses nicely to about a 100-150 millisecond window, which I'll show you.
So you have
your eye tracker? Yeah, so I'll explain that also a bit. I should have said that. So the animal also has an eye coil implanted under its conjunctiva. This doesn't bother them at all. Minor surgery. It's a small piece of biomedical wire that runs out to the back of the head. So there's this loop of wire. The animal sits in a magnetic field, horizontal and vertical magnetic fields. And so when the eye changes position, it can detect changes in the current in the coil and measure eye position with an accuracy noise of about 0.025 degrees. Accuracy is mainly limited by calibration of the animal, getting him to fixate various points, and it's about 0.1 degree.
So And so then the eye tracker says, then the eye tracker is what uses, is what determines whether or not to reward the animal.
For the response, right. But you could use even a simpler system to do that. And we needed the eye tracker for very fine control of stimulus placement, which I'll show you in a moment. But those regions, I guess I didn't point that out, that screen that the animal was looking at is about plus or minus 13 degrees. Okay, so, you know, as Tommy was saying, your thumb is about, it's about 1 degree at arm's length. So, you know, it's a region, you know, about arm's width is what the screen would look like, the entire screen. So those are reasonably large saccades, about 11 degree saccades to those response windows. And we didn't require very high accuracy to go to those locations. It would just get to this general region, just like I wouldn't require you to enunciate A in exactly the same pattern, or you know, you wouldn't get reward. As long as you were in that region of response space, you would still get rewarded.
So you assume that the stimulus response arc, so to speak, goes through IT and then prefrontal and then motor. What's the evidence or the reasoning to assume that it doesn't go through the parietal lobe and then prefrontal?
Well, it's kind of the evidence that I've been reviewing for you in that lesions here generally disrupt recognition.
But this kind of task, I mean,
right, so,
you don't see recognition, you see stimulus response.
And there is now some data that neurons can actually be selective for stimuli up in parietal cortex as well. So potentially this is all routed.
Especially you know, the trend, I guess.
Right. So this is actually part of the problem with a lot of neurophysiology is all we can do is go in and record responses and try to infer their role in the behavior. So some of the things that I'm planning to do is to try to inactivate this local region in, while the animal is performing the task to better say that, yes, these neurons are involved. Some of the indirect evidence that is involved is one is the selectivity, which I'll show you, and there are a large number of neurons down here that I can find that are selective for those four stimuli, which you saw are very similar, and you wouldn't expect that for naive animals to have a lot of selectivity for those four very similar looking stimuli without some training, and you'd wonder why would it train up neurons in this area to distinguish them if it wasn't going to use them. But of course that's not proof, that's just suggestive evidence. But I think the only way you can do this is intervene, either stimulation or say a mucimol injection or something to block activity or enhance activity here to show that you can perturb the behavior. And so that's some of the direction that we need to go. The other things that we're going to think about doing along those lines are looking at the relationship between neural activity, the onset of neural activity here, and the initiation of the response. So the animal, trial by trial basis, right, relation to reaction time.
Why do you use eye movement for response other than, say, manipulating
part of it is I wanted to actually have at least four stimuli the animal would have to distinguish. And so I'd have to maybe do a joystick or something. That's difficult for the animal to learn. This is much easier for the animal to learn. The other nice thing about this is with joysticks, you always have inertia problems or, you know, the animal's hand wasn't exactly in the right place when the trial started. So that if you want to look at this trial by trial, say, reaction time data, with eye movements, you get very precise millisecond resolution of when that movement began. Whereas with the, say, manipulandum, you're not actually monitoring the arm, you're monitoring, there's some coupling in there that you might miss, right? So there might be an extra lag that because the animal wasn't in the right place, even though it started to move its arm, it had to hit the manipulandum. Things like that, which can, I think, muddy your estimates of reaction time. It's just a cleaner estimate. The other reason is that we know much more about the areas involved in controlling eye movements than we do about the details of how you would code a movement of the arm, say, or the foot, if you're going to use a foot lever. You can train animals to do that, but for the reasons I think I just outlined, we use the eye movements. Does that answer the question? Okay. So all the data that I'm going to show you today came from two rhesus monkeys. This is, again, for those of you who don't know, it's extracellular recording of single neuron action potentials. It's a small wire, gets lowered down into infratemporal cortex. We actually come in from the ventral surface, a guide tube gets placed to about this depth, and then so this is, you have to imagine a coronal section. So this is running through the brain, and then we reach these regions of IT by driving an electrode with a microdrive. And over many days of recording, we explore up and down and back and forth in this plane, about a 10 by 10 millimeter region of the ventral STS and the ventral surface. These are both the primary parts of IT. This sulcus is called the STS, superior temporal sulcus. And so you can imagine it's folding into the brain. And so as our electrode comes through, we go through both banks of it, and the ventral bank is part of anterior IT, and then we can record down on the ventral surface of the brain here, which is also part of IT. We can't quite reach out all the way to the very lateral surface in anterior IT here, which is just something I've also to point out to that different groups record in different parts of IT. And so, for instance, this Tanaka group has a different approach and comes in this way. The areas where we're recording are more similar to the areas that Logothetis was recording in, and groups like Earl Miller, just for reference if anybody's interested in that. But we explored a very large region of it. We think we could get almost all of it. And in fact, we found about 220 neurons that were responsive to some aspect of the task while we're recording. So the way the procedure goes is the animal's in the room doing the identification task. Stimuli are being presented, the animal's making responses, and we drive the electrode until we hear neurons, listen to the multi-unit activity, if we can detect with online histograms whether there's some modulation selective or not. We try to isolate a neuron, and then we will record the neuron for as long as we can hold it. And that's the procedure that's done in all these kinds of studies. Now, any questions about methods of recording?
How do you get in there?
How do you get in the beginning? So I was trying to say, the skull's up here. So during the surgery, we make a small window here. Chamber sits up here. A microdrive gets mounted above it, and then we place a guide tube, which is a very small kind of hypodermic needle, essentially, down to about this depth. This is, of course, through the brain, not on the surface. And then the electrode gets inserted in the guide tube, and we then drive the microdrive, which moves by hydraulics to drive the electrode down to this depth. And as we're driving, we can hear neurons, and we go at a rate that's you can stop if you need to record a neuron and listen to the multi-unit. We very slowly crawl the electrode down into this region. Again, all while the animal is performing the task.
The animal is performing the task, and it's not anesthetized at all, or it's anesthetized partially, or?
It's not anesthetized at all.
Oh.
And right, so there are no pain sensors in the brain, so it doesn't notice this at all. And you can see from days when you don't record you don't place the electrode, and days you do, the animal's behavior is identical. He seems to be completely unaware of this, which is what you'd expect given no sensors in there. And this and the width of this wire is on the order of 20-30 microns. At the tip is about 2 microns. Single electrode, that's all we've been using.
Single unit of loading?
Yes. Single electrode, single unit.
And they're going to use by itself?
But we use just a standard discrimination window and accept 3-to-1 noise ratio.
One unit
at a time. So we record, usually in a day we'll get 4 units, so we'll record from one unit for half an hour, and then we'll go on to another unit for half an hour until we've got enough data for the task that...
How do you make sure it's only one unit?
So the electrical signal can be, the waveform can be clearly distinguished on the oscilloscope using a, and so continuous monitored, it's human monitoring, it's myself
just
sitting
on the oscilloscope.
Just on the oscilloscope, right. The data I'm going to tell you about today was from 220 responsive neurons, and this is an example of what we call a target selective neuron. So in what was going on here is the animal was staring at the center of the screen, fixation point, a small dot of light comes up, and then the animal stares at the fixation point, and then one of the 4 stimuli randomly comes up, in this case directly over the fixation point, and then the animal goes and makes its response, again as fast, as quickly as it likes. And he does this for many trials, all randomly interleaved. What I've shown down here are the spike data from those trials. Now I've sorted them out by target identity. Again, they were all random, but here they're sorted. Each row is a different trial, so I think there are about 10 trials. So this is 40 trials, which might take the animal about 5 or 10 minutes to run through this. These tick marks here, each tick mark is an action potential detected with the discriminator on the oscilloscope. And what you can see here is that the time 0 is the time that the target actually appears on the screen. And about 100, 150 milliseconds later, you can see that when this target appears on the screen, the neuron starts to increase its response rate. And you can see this is repeatable over trials. Whereas when these other targets are occurring, this one is a little bit, but very little response to these other targets. And this upper plot is just the histogram of this. As you can see the rate here, it's a nice response, 60 spikes per second. So this neuron is clearly selective for this target over these other targets. We, of course, aren't the first to show this, only for our specific targets. I just showed you all that data from other labs where they'd shown selectivity. This is to show you that we found nice selectivity for these four targets in our particular task. And these gold bars indicate the range of times that the animal began its response saccade. So as early as about 200 to 220 milliseconds, and usually as late as around 300 to 350. It's cut off here a little at the end. But so the range, the median is about 250 milliseconds. And you can see that's true for all targets. And what you can also get from this is if these neurons are involved, which we were just discussing, that there's really a short time window from when the response begins at around 100, 150 milliseconds, the neural response begins, and the behavioral response begins. The window there is about 150, 100 milliseconds. And this is that short physiological, meaningful time window that I alluded to earlier. So now we can say, well, this is the region that we should be analyzing the neural responses, because first of all, the latencies are too long, so there's no response out here. And clearly, it doesn't make sense to argue that responses out here are driving the animal's recognition behavior. So by allowing the animal to go as quickly as we like, we can better constrain where to look for the neural responses.
Did you also subtract some window even before?
Right, so we, yeah, so then we don't know how much to subtract, and we've done it. So we can estimate, you know, about 50 milliseconds maybe to subtract.
How
maximum.
Much is left for what?
The other
for the movement the brain has
some other neural processes. So there'll be some other processes that intervene between this and the
process. I mean, could be a continuous process. It's not necessarily like chunk of brain,
right?
Chunk of movement, and then
right. And especially with the trial by trial variability, so you could subtract back off a particular trial. And we've tried a whole bunch of different ways of doing it. It doesn't change the general results, the details of exactly where you put this window. But we still think this is an improvement over saying let the animal hold and you know the target stays up and he waits a whole second or more and the response fluctuates around and then it's not saying we can really nail it down, it's just better. That's the point.
What's your rough estimate of how much time it should take for the monkey to make a decision not to generate the movement?
To make a decision, what does that mean?
To process the stimulus and say decide where it wants to make its decision.
Well, right, so to decide it, I mean, there's no little man in there, right? So this, we like to think this is part of the decision. I mean, so we think that if this connected to frontal eye field, which I showed you, there you might have a 20 millisecond, responses there might begin about 20 milliseconds or so before the response saccade. So you might subtract
a... These questions have to record the motor neuron.
Right, we have to record across different areas in the same task, and that's actually what we're doing. We've been recording in frontal eye field. Which isn't quite motor, but it's getting there. It's in that direction.
You assume that the identification is done in IT. It's done there, right?
We assume
the answers.
Our kind of working model is that IT has sorted out and created a representation which is sufficient to drive motor responses to different regions of the space.
So you have something different. One out of four possibilities, possible representations generated in IT. Right. Before sending on.
Right.
So the question I would say is how long do you think it takes for IT to generate these four distinct representations?
Well, so you can see immediately, you know, that within, well, you'd have to say it's going to depend on the number of neurons and noise levels and all those kind of things. But you can see it's somewhere about 100, about 50 milliseconds or less, I would guess. You know, so that's my ballpark estimate. And I'll show you some more time course data at the end and we can talk about this.
Do you think the monkey is aware from the beginning that's going to be presented?
He is aware, and the timing, so there's issues of, you know, so there's timing for the task, so he acquires a fixation point, and then we have a fixed waiting time for when this comes on. So we actually, in these trials, he knows that, well, as best he can, you know, thousands of trials, he knows pretty darn well something's about to come on here, and he's going to have to do this task. So presumably that gets all his prefrontal cortex and everything controlling attentional set and context and all that into position for this to happen, but of course the differential responses could never begin until the stimulus actually came up, unless the animal started to guess. But he's working at 90% accuracy, so he isn't doing much guessing at all. I don't know. Does that answer your question? So he knows it's going to happen, but he doesn't know what it is, of course.
But he could prepare for one of the four responses and then inhibit or...
He could prime all four and then one could, you know, three of them could go down. That's exactly true.
What's the spontaneous level of activity in
IT? I'm sorry?
Spontaneous level of activity.
You can kind of get a sense of it here. This is a little high. Well, there's a fixation point, and yeah, it's about 5 to 10 spikes per second, if you call that high. I think the average was, 8 spikes per second over all the neurons that we recorded.
So it sounds like
V1. Okay, so V1 in the dark, or, okay, so these monkeys are never in the complete dark. They've got that screen, right? So there's always stimuli up. So I don't know what the proper comparison would be. At the end, delay activity. So if he held it in memory or something, or what? But so I don't let him do that. That was kind of one of the things that I advantages about this task. I'm not interested in. Well, we can record, but you say how far does the response continue off? I don't know. I mean, it takes time for this to decay, but I don't know what the exact. I haven't looked at that. Well, I'll show you the time course average at the end, and maybe we can.
It still didn't decay back to 5.
It's still on its way down. Yeah, I think if I follow this out, it comes back to baseline level pretty quickly. Of course, we've lost all control at this point. The animal's making a movement, then making a different movement, and different trials. He could go to different places after that's cut. Then he goes and, you know, just wanders around the screen. I'll show you that in a second. So everything after there is kind of muddy data, and so we don't really make too much out of it because we don't have control over the conditions. Here we've got very precise control of what's on the retina.
Is the
intertoilet fixed? No, it's about on the second, but we put in some randomization so it doesn't become too routine, but that doesn't seem to matter. We put in about 200, plus or minus 200 milliseconds.
So when you were training monkey onto those four letters in the alphabet, did you also train him on like larger alphabet, like 10 letters, but he was only supposed to succumb to these four? And then
No, I mean, that sounds like a good experiment. Maybe we could talk about it later. But we only trained on these particular four and a fifth distractor stimulus, which was similar to these, and I'll show you that one in a minute, that he didn't have to make a response to. So I guess that's like your other 10, but he only had to identify these four. The only way that you can know that an animal's identifying stimuli, say we had all 10, The only way we could know is that we'd have to then have 10 responses or 10 ways of distinguishing of the animal telling me, I know that's different from number 9 and so forth. And that, of course, gets to be a problem with training and complexity of the task. So that's why we stuck with 4 for the moment.
Okay, so you didn't have a distractor.
We did have one distractor, but I would like to go up to more distractors, which we could easily do if you don't require the animal to identify the distractor, just to identify the targets. We could do that.
I mean, the paradigm, so that's kind of interesting, that Nikos used was to show one object for a minute or so, and this was understood by the monkey to be the target. And then other patterns came up, and each time the monkey had to say a binary,
yes statement, or no.
Is it the target or is not?
Right.
That's another way.
Right. And then you can use more targets.
Yeah.
Right. But it's harder to think about for me the neural mechanism of, well, what's the mapping? In that case, you require the animal to have a dynamic map between the current target and the yes button. Where in this case, it's a fixed sensory motor map, if you will, the way I outlined it at the beginning. And the animal can do a dynamic map, but it seems to introduce a level of complexity that it gains you something, but you may lose something as well. Maybe we should talk about that a bit at the end.
The connectivity of the pathway from AIT to whatever region causes the saccade, is that connectivity consistent with this measured delay, if you like, in the onset of the saccade, or...?
So you mean the, say, frontal eye field, which is one area that we think might drive these. Are the latencies of frontal eye field neurons longer than the latencies of IT neurons? Because
first of all, when do the saccades come?
When?
What is the delay
for the outside of the saccades relative to the stimulus of PA.
Well, that's what these yellow bars are. Maybe I didn't explain that clearly, but this is the time that the responses initiate. Now, of course, they're not all exactly at one time. The saccade. So the saccade begins right at say, 250 milliseconds on average from when the stimulus comes on.
And so in terms of pathways, is that reasonable, this delay between the response and
IT? Well, it depends on the question that was asked earlier. How much integration in IT do you have to use before you can drive the next neuron? And it is consistent because it's only about 20 milliseconds between, say, V2 and V4. It might be a little longer between IT and frontal eye fields. So you add another, move this back another 20 milliseconds, you're still in front. In superior colliculus, which moves eyes very almost motor neuron-like, there you're talking about 10 milliseconds before the saccades and neurons are 10 to 20. So you've still got plenty of time if the integration is about 50 milliseconds or so, even up to 100, I think. And this neuron is actually starting a little later than most. The average is about 100 to 125. But you've got plenty of time to go through about two or three more stages.
If that neuron is driving the saccade or telling the saccade to take place, you're going to have to wait until its activity gets above background before it. So it's not really the latency. It may be time, maybe the peak or three quarters of the way up to the peak or something.
Right.
Has to be considerably above that.
Yes. Well, that's what the integration time is about.
Could be some colonel's activity there. If you have a population that all of them at a given millisecond just fire, then that's the area.
It's not clear how. What you're saying is that it could happen very quickly here if you've got a lot of neurons going all at once. That could be a strong enough signal, first of all. The other thing is, even if you only relied on this neuron, I'm saying, yes, integrate over the first 50 milliseconds, as you're pointing out. If you had an integration window of 50 milliseconds, then I still think there's enough time here to drive one or two more stages.
And one or two more stages is what you would think you would have to drive.
Minimally, yes. If there was some really circuitous route, then we'd run out of time, I think. But these timing issues are just all being worked out. But they're good ones. And it's a good reason to go and explore these other areas and look at the timing, which is something that we're doing.
I think there is this paper by Simon Thorpe with U-Books.
Oh, yes.
In which it's a recognition task and defines evidence in the EEG that there seems to be a correlation with whether the subject recognized correctly or not. And this, he says, is about 120 milliseconds after onset of the stimulus. The motor response is only 400 milliseconds or so, because he's measuring, I think, pressing buttons. And it's much more variable.
So how does he know that it's only 120 by masking?
No, he gets a differential response, say to like trees and people or something. And he present either tree or person, and job is to say tree or person. I don't remember those exact stimuli, but classes.
How do you know when processing is done?
Well, it's not when it's done, but he's saying that you get a differential response beginning around 100, 150 milliseconds after stimulus onset, which is completely consistent with this kind of differential EEG response.
And then there is some vague guess. There is another data that seems to come from a region around IT in humans. But that's
okay. So I have a couple more slides, and then there's kind of a point where maybe it'd be a good time to take a little break. Okay. So So I showed you an example of a target selective neuron in the last slide, and I told you earlier on that we actually found a fair amount of these in anterior IT, and this is the frequency of target selective neurons we found. Of course, there's always two monkeys. They were about the same frequency, which is nice. About a third of the neurons that we recorded as being responsive were selective by an ANOVA 0.01. Now, but of course, the exact number depends on exactly where you set this criterion. It's not as if you've got neurons that aren't responsive and neurons that are really responsive. It's more as a continuum. So it's difficult to say exactly how many of these neurons are actually, say, participating in the task. And this is just to give you a feel for the numbers of neurons that at least could participate in making a distinction between those four stimuli. And Interestingly, most of these were located in a small region on the ventral surface. So I said we explored a bigger region on both the ventral STS and the ventral surface. Almost all of the neurons were in a small region and we were able to explore around that region on the ventral surface. So it's as if we may have recruited a specialized subregion for learning complex objects.
But in this small region, how many neurons still did not respond to the basketball?
It's difficult to do this because, as I point out, the method is you go down, you record, you're listening to multi-unit, and if you don't hear any modulation
during,
or
during the task.
So as you're driving the electrode, right. So and then you'll stop and watch a few trials. If you watch all day, then you run out, you never get any data. So you have a limited time to observe and decide, is this area seem to be...
What's your impression?
What percentage of what?
Of cells that you go through.
In this hot region, in the hot part.
Yes, in the hot part.
Yeah, so I think about 10 to 20%, somewhere around there, of all cells. That would be my guess. But I don't even know how to say that because we don't know if the electrode can actually hear all cells.
It doesn't.
Somewhere in the ballpark, probably a little smaller than these numbers you're suggesting.
So this area was in the same location in this tobacco?
Within a millimeter or two. Right. Yeah, sorry.
How do you explain that the summing of cells are responsive to as much, like, as I see it, not too much complex, and they're only four. But it's not because, like, out of the 90 million cells, it seems like 30 million are responsive to...
Right. Well, that's what I was kind of trying to say. It's more like, okay, the way this gets done is, you're a realist here, and you don't. It's not a completely unbiased estimate. That's why I didn't want to make too much out of these numbers, because you explore the space and you're not getting any responsivity, and in a region you're getting a lot of responsivity. So then, after you've kind of explored that, that's the 90 million space, or maybe a little less. Then you go back on later days and say, okay, we're going to focus on this region here where we got a lot of responsivity, which of course starts to increase the percentage of total neurons that you actually recorded anywhere. So it's maybe 10% in that region, which is only about 20% of all of IT. So I wouldn't say that 30 million neurons are responsive. This is suggesting it's still a pretty large number are selected for these four stimuli. They might say that's four, and the animal's got thousands of things it may have to learn.
Not that complex. I mean, if comparing to natural stimuli,
So that's exactly right. This is all the animal does for a living, right? So it's not clear that that's too many or too few, but it's true what you're saying is he's going to run out of neurons probably after 100 or objects like these if he really continued at this rate. And maybe that's all the data suggests. I mean, or maybe he'd find a better way to code it, or maybe, as I was saying, it's only a few percentage of these that are really driving this. The others have gained some selectivity, but then if I put them in another task, they could get pushed off and he could still do it. I mean, these are all, we don't know the answers. This is just to give you a feel for what we'd find when we're recording. I mean, your point is well taken. I mean, you're not, a third of the brain shouldn't be, a third of IT shouldn't be doing this. But it's hard to say because it's his life.
Neural responses during training.
Yeah, so the standard model is to train the animal and then start recording, or else it's trying to, like, hit a moving target. So we don't have any data on that. Some people have tried to look at that. And of course, you can't hold the same neuron over many days, and if the training takes months, so it's a very difficult question, but a very interesting one. So there have been some groups which say record. Kobataki, actually, in Tanaka's group, did this. Record an IT, anesthetized animal, get an idea of the selectivity, then train the animal, then go back and record, and they see more selectivity for the objects. So it would be interesting to do the same thing with these four kind of arbitrary objects. You would expect, I think you're still going to get something because they contain features that maybe were relevant to the animal at some point. So there's some percentage, but I think it would be smaller than this number. So there's an issue of some of these neurons are really probably tuned to these objects, and others are tuned to something else. And I call it the skirt of the response, right? So I'm seeing tuning to something else that just happens to coincide with these stimuli, and then those neurons might not even be used in this task. But these are all issues that are open. Okay, so I was going to move on. So this is probably a good place to pause if people want to take a break. It's been about almost an hour and a half. Yeah, I think I have, at this rate, maybe another hour, maybe a little more. Okay, so now I'm going to tell you about some specific manipulations that we did. After we got an animal doing a task, we had selectivity like other people had. Now we wanted to ask some specific questions about the representation. So most of what I've told you is kind of background and method so far, and now I'll show you some actual results. So the first thing I'm going to talk about is the effect of free viewing on the IT representation. And I kind of view this as a state effect question. It's like, what's the effect of attention or changes in attention? And I'll show you what I mean by free viewing on this slide. This is a slide that is from a book by Yarbus. So if you looked at an image like this, and I asked you to say, identify how many people are in the image, and I give you a second to do that. So I'm not sure what number you came up with. It depends if you count these pictures back here. But what you're doing is making lots of eye movements, even though you don't realize it. And Yarbus asked subjects to do tasks such as this. And the way he recorded their pattern of eye movements, this is one of his tracings. And what happens, of course, is as you explore scenes, that you make saccades, which are rapid movements of the eyes, of variable duration, which depends on their amplitude. But they're on the order of, say, 10 to 50 milliseconds or so, followed by pauses or fixations, which, of course, include slow drifts and tremors that we were talking about yesterday. But relative fixation, so ballistic eye movements, fixations, which last on the order of 150 to 500 milliseconds, and then followed by additional saccade fixation, saccade fixation, saccade fixation. So as you're performing recognition of faces and objects and scenes in general, you're making lots of eye movements over the scene in the way you would naturally look at the world. I want to contrast this with the way experiments are normally done, and the way the data I've shown you so far has almost all been collected, at least that in awake animals, and is that it's called controlled viewing. And what you do is, so I can illustrate it for you here. So if you could stare at that red dot, now you're the monkey and this is your job, stare at the red dot, and now tell me how many pictures are on the wall. Don't move your eyes, okay? You gotta keep staring at the dot. So you can see this is a kind of a perverse and difficult thing to do, but this is what we ask the animals to do, and this is part of the reason that it's hard to train animals to do tasks and why it takes a long time. So there's a methodological issue of using free viewing because it's more natural and therefore easy to train animals, but there's also a scientific issue of does free viewing alter neuronal responses? That is, does the animal performing lots of eye movements change the way that that information is represented, say in an area like infratemporal cortex? And so if you wanted to study this, you could say, well, okay, let's go. Let's take the red dot away and tell the animal to do whatever they want, move their eyes all over the place, and say, look for faces or look for my four stimuli. The problem is that you saw those eye movements, they're under the animal's control, and so it's very difficult to get reproducible retinal stimulation. We could wait a long time and eventually he'd happen to get the right conditions, but if you just let the animal scan the scene, you don't have any control over where he's going to look and when he's going to look there. What we came up with is a kind of a set of methods to overcome this difficulty, but we still think still capture free viewing and then be able to get reproducible stimulation on the retina in free viewing animals. And so I'm going to walk you through for the next few slides how we were able to get animals recognizing those objects that I told you in a free viewing kind of situation. Now it's going to be reduced from this situation, but I think it captures most of the important elements. So here is one of the stimuli that I just showed you earlier. And for all the stimuli, what we did was, when they were presented, they were actually filtered with a difference of Gaussians. Okay, so this, as you'll see, just makes them difficult to see when they're out in the far periphery. But what I'll show you for the rest of it is just a schematic of this. I won't show you the filtered versions. So here is one of the stimuli. The other thing we did to it besides filtering it is to present it at a small size compared to most studies of IT. So usually stimuli are about 3 to 5 degrees. We use stimuli that were about 0.6 degrees. So they're smaller than what's normally used. And the reason we did this is because when we made them small, we could embed them in an array of distractors. So we mentioned there was a fifth stimulus that was a distractor. So this is a stimulus you haven't seen before. And it's serving as a distractor. And you can see that it's identical in all of these. There's a target sitting here, one of those four stimuli. And it's sitting in a row of distractors. And I'll refer to these distractors as clutter occasionally. And the spacing is 1.5 degrees, just to give you an idea of the scale here. Again, that's a little more than the distance of your thumb at arm's length. And we tuned this. So the reason we did the filtering and the size was that we could get conditions that worked essentially like this. So stimuli that were within about 4 or 5 degrees were discriminable. That is, by psychophysical testing, the animal could reliably identify and distinguish between targets placed at this range of stimuli. Of course, this isn't like a hard limit. There's a gradual fall off in his performance, but this is the general region. Out here, he could detect stimuli, that is, make eye movements to them, indicating he detected them, but they were not discriminable, just as they were here. So he says there's something out there, but he can't identify what it was. And then because the stimuli were high pass filtered and essentially, and they were isoluminant, the average luminance was the same as background, Average luminance was the same as background. They tended to essentially be invisible. So if you were staring at the actual stimulus array and staring right here, you actually wouldn't be able to see much out here. And you'd easily be able to discriminate targets here and detect them in this region. And the reason we did all this is because now we have a situation where the animal is aware that there is this row of stimuli, but he can't always identify targets anywhere in the row just by staring at one point in space. He has to make lots of eye movements along this array trying to find target stimuli. So he's making lots of eye movements trying to find targets. So he's exploring this somewhat reduced visual scene, like the scene I showed you earlier, trying to find targets, which we're going to insert. And I'll show you the way we inserted these targets. And that's illustrated on this slide here. The animal, this is the current animal's current center of fixation. This is that portion of that distractor row. So this is about 6 degrees, or actually 10 degrees of visual angle. The regions I just showed you are somewhat like this. He can, if there was a target here, he would be able to tell that, and he could see things out there. So he says, I know there's an array of targets or array of stimuli, and I'm going to look for a target, and I'm going to head out this way. He's about to make a saccade from here to here looking for a target, and I'm going to show you this slowdown. This is 100-fold, slowed down 100-fold. So the time is up here in seconds. So here he goes. Whoops, that didn't work. Here he goes. So he makes the saccade, and about halfway through the saccade, you see we turned off the stimuli, and then just as the saccade ends, we re-illuminated the entire row. So mid-saccade, something changed. We don't think the animal noticed this because it was during the saccade. And then just as the saccade ended, we re-illuminated the row. Now you may have noticed it actually slightly shifted position, and I've now inserted a target where there was no target before. Okay, so now the animal's staring directly at a target stimulus, whereas before that was a distractor in that position. And because I've adjusted the row slightly, the animal's center of gaze is now centered directly on that target. So he thinks, or we think, that he thinks that he just got lucky and happened to go out there and land on a target. And we can present this anywhere. We chose to do it on the center. We could present targets on the side. Of course, we could present this in any position around here. And we would randomly jitter the presentation of non-target stimuli and present targets in these three positions. And the data I'm going to show you at first is all from data trials where the target was presented just as I showed you here, where it was inserted directly at the center of gaze just after a saccade. Okay, so still walking you through this. This is what a trial would look like now slowed down tenfold. Here are the response locations. He has this row of stimuli, which you can't discriminate at this scale. But he's going to come in here and start previewing, looking for targets. And then I'm going to insert one, just as I showed you. And he'll detect it and make the appropriate response saccade and identify the target. So this is, again, slowed down. This is 1/10 normal speed. So you see for small saccades, nothing happens. For larger saccades, the stimuli turn off, as I showed you, and then occasionally a target gets inserted randomly. and just as I showed you on the earliest slide, and then he correctly went up there and identified it. Okay, so now we're up to full speed. I'm just going to show you about 10 trials of the animal running through this. He's making lots of eye movements, trying to find targets and then identifying them. You hear a little beep when he gets a correct response, and you'll notice that the stimuli are flashing on and off, and that's really obvious to you watching here, but we don't think it's obvious to the animal, because first they were average luminance was zero, as I pointed out, and this is all happening during the animal saccade, but you're just staring at the screen. But this just gives you a sense of the pace of the task. So here he goes. So he makes two or three eye movements across the array looking for targets, and then on average, then something gets inserted and he identifies it. So you can see him looking around, got one. So you can't see the targets appearing, but you can infer from his responses that...
When he jumps in between the targets, it is a beep every time, right? Sometimes you just jump between the two targets.
Well, remember, there are no targets up at all.
Two
distractors.
The two motor outlets.
Oh, you mean, so often at the end of a trial, he'll go down here and then he'll zip around over there or something.
Or just go to the middle in between.
Yeah, and that's wrong. I have big windows. As I said, I didn't require accuracy. The windows are actually some very large windows, as long as he kind of goes in the right direction. And the reason I did that is because if a target was here, you kind of want him to just have to make the same eye movement, and you wouldn't want to penalize him to have to make this huge eye movement back over here. So this way he can still make essentially the same eye movement he made over here and get the appropriate response. He just has to kind of go in the right quadrant to get the right response. So all of this kind of trickery for the animal, and the reason we did this is because we were able to then get retinal stimulation which was accurate and reproducible even in these free viewing animals. So this is the boundary of eye positions for 95% of the trials. This is a stimulus. You can see this is about, you know, plus or minus 0.1 degree or so. And this is a target stimulus just for scale. And so at the end of all those, when those targets were inserted, as I showed you, that it was reliably inserted with this accuracy on the retina, even in these free-viewing animals. So again, now one more schematic to illustrate the comparison that I'm going to make. So we wanted to compare free-viewing and controlled viewing. So here's this target, the distractor array. I've illustrated that on this plot here. This is horizontal eye position. This is now time. The gray bars here indicate each of these, is a schematic of each of these distractors. The green line is the animal's current eye position. So just like that one trial I showed you in slow motion, the animal is making an eye movement. We turn off the stimulus, turn it back on. You can see it's not exactly centered in this case because there was random jitter, so he didn't always land exactly on stimuli. Again, he stares for about 150, 200 milliseconds, makes another saccade, same thing off and on. Short saccades or nearby saccades, nothing changed in the array. And then here's another large saccade where we happen to insert a target stimulus, again, directly on the center of gaze. The animal stares at it for about 250, 300 milliseconds, then makes his response saccade to the appropriate corner, which you can't see. This is just horizontal position, but this is the initiation of his response saccade, and he's correct. Okay, so that's a schematic of what we did, and what we wanted to compare it to, so this is an animal making lots of eye movements, was the standard way that people present stimuli, that is under controlled viewing conditions. And so I forgot to point out at the beginning, but part of the reason that we're doing this is because some studies have suggested that early visual areas were actually different in these kind of situations in controlled versus free viewing. So besides it being the way we naturally do things, there was already some suggestion that things might be different. So we wanted to compare controlled and free viewing. This is the example of what happens during a standard controlled viewing trial, and this is how most people run tasks. At least at the start here, a fixation point comes on. I've already somewhat described this to you. The animal acquires a fixation point, and then there's a fixed time here of 300 milliseconds where he has to hold fixation, and then a target appears, just like in this case, and here directly again on the center of gaze, flanked by the same set of distractors that you see here. So this arrow indicates that at this time point, across these conditions, the stimulus conditions are comparable, are nominally identical between controlled and free viewing. So we're able to make comparisons, and we look at neural responses here and ask, does any of this free-viewing context affect responses to this target stimulus? So we've held retinal stimulation constant, and so what's different? Well, we've got lots of eye movements occurring here, so that's essentially the free-viewing, where we've got fixation, we've got a fixating animal here. We've got a stimulus being inserted directly after an eye movement, so there could be something like parapsychotic suppression or something about motor intention that could alter the neural responses. And the other thing is the animal, as someone pointed out, knows that the target is going to, or something's going to happen at this point in time that he's going to need to respond to. Whereas here, each one of these saccades, large saccades, could initiate a target presentation, but it only happens occasionally, so he doesn't know when he's going to have to actually make the response. So with all those differences, then we could ask, well, do we really see any difference in their responses? We've equated retinal stimulation, but everything, we've got all these other differences, and we can ask, is there any difference in response?
What happens if you don't do this trick of inserting the targets, but you just place the target somewhere? And
yeah, right, so that I should have said that, but suppose that we had inserted it, well, let's suppose we had inserted it exactly at this spot, so it was always on right here, right? And he started here, and yeah, he wouldn't know that it's there because he, you know, it's too far out of his range. But suppose he did exactly this, and suppose that, you know, I suppose it was one over, that he might have seen it or seen part of it, and he went away, and then he came back. Well, so did he gain some information about it, and that could alter the responses? And then now he came back and thought. So that's an interesting question, but it would kind of modify. We wouldn't therefore be able to say that he got equal information about target visually in these cases. We essentially lose the control that we're trying to gain.
This is what would happen here, that he would see it, then come back, he wouldn't immediately make a decision.
Well, it depends how close it is, and you know, so that, yeah, and then he would come back, and then we'd still need to adjust it to equate these conditions exactly, or else replay those in a different. So there are different.
More difficult to compare.
Exactly, that's right. That was the main reason. So it's a little funny that it seems that the target's never up, but the way we structure these conditions to this animal, you know, he doesn't know this, we think. The target could be up over here for all he knows, or actually turn out over here. And he's just looking around, and he knows that he can't see everything at once, so he has to make lots of eye movements to try to find it. So we hope it seems relatively natural to him, and that it's not things just popping up. But, you know, it can't be completely, because he was just here, and he has any memory that there was nothing there that might be a little strange. But you could view it as, you know, he's looking in the field, and, like, bugs are occasionally appearing, but he can't look at them all at once. You know, he wants to grab the bug.
But if there is a target there, he would naturally stop.
Right.
So he makes a decision, and then he recognizes the fact that this is an interesting target very quickly at that point.
Well, he does right here. You can see how long it takes him to. It actually causes him to pause slightly.
It causes him to pause now to make the decision which target it is.
Yes.
But he stops there rather than move on.
Yes, so he holds, right, so that's a good point. So he's making saccades at a rate of about one every 200 milliseconds, but his response time is a little longer than that, it's about 300, so he's able to kind of stop whatever. So you imagine a clock, it's actually very clock-like if I show you the distribution. Every 200 milliseconds, movement, 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 movement. This is a little strange here, there's a rapid movement in here. Movement, 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 hold an extra 100 and then go. And you kind of saw that in the movie I showed you. It's movement, and then you almost saw him kind of tight move a tiny bit, and then when made the response. I don't know if any of you remember that from the movie. He does occasionally miss the target and move away from it. And we can talk about the neural responses from those trials as well, because that's an interesting question. Yeah, so then if he moves away, it's shorter on average. It's like he didn't stop his search mechanism, whatever that is. He couldn't control it.
I think this seems to me a very important point. I mean, when we saccade, we really move to points which have kind of high contrast in the visual field. Right?
Yeah.
Now, when the monkey saccades, you know, within these distractors, I mean, there's no question of contrast, really, because they're all the same. But there are some that are targets and some that are not. So somehow he recognizes the fact that this is a target very quickly, maybe within a millisecond maybe, when he decides to stop the saccade there.
Well, he doesn't recognize in a millisecond, right? Because he
doesn't.
Well, we don't know when he recognized it. We know when activity in IT begins, and you saw it earlier. It begins around here, 100 milliseconds. But if this wasn't here, you can infer from his other movements that he would have moved here. So he doesn't really need to, he doesn't show me the evidence that he recognized it until the IQ neurons actually start to respond, which makes a whole lot of sense, right?
He discriminates at this point already.
Yes.
But the question, I mean, the reason we succumb to points of high contrast is because these are presumably points of interest, right?
Yes.
And for the animal to decide, for the monkey to decide which one of these squares is of interest, it means that it very quickly can tell somehow that this is not the distractor.
I'm not sure I'm following you. He's saccading to kind of all, they're all distractors, so they're all kind of equal contrast.
Which one they choose is just the chance.
Yeah.
Well, it didn't look like that in the experiment that showed.
Oh, you mean in this slide or an earlier slide? How did it not look like
that? The earlier one. I mean, when you decide to show him a target, it's after he stopped saccading?
Yes.
Oh, sorry.
Yeah, so he was already going there. I could predict where it was going to go, so I knew approximately where to put the target, but I waited just so I could get the X exactly right, so it came up less than 10 milliseconds of when it saccaded, which is like one video frame. Right, so that he's driving the target presentation, but we hope he doesn't really know that.
Okay,
so
then in every pause, he has to do the discrimination as well. He just decided this is not the target.
Yes, every pause we think he's, to the extent that, you know,
in principle, it should take the same amount of time. So it's only the motor preparation that the extra amount of time.
I agree. So I think, and the responses of IT are nicely tuned to be, you know, to get going around 100 in time to maybe stop the motor system. And if they don't say there's something here, it's not clear that IT is stopping it. They may just be IT is identifying it. Something else is saying target versus no target. And we don't know that, but IT could be stopping it. But I think you're exactly right. Every movement is, there's an activity, no activity, activity, no activity. Should I stop? Should I stop?
There's decision making.
Decision making every saccade, in every fixation.
Right. How did you predict where he was going or
Well, so because I could detect the onset and I can see the direction. Saccades are ballistic movements in generally one direction, so I can predict with some accuracy where he'll be. But it really didn't matter because I waited till, as I said, the last video frame just as he stopped to insert it, so I didn't have to predict. But on some control trials, which I did, I inserted it earlier and I would have, that's how I predicted, because saccades are ballistic movements. So once they start and you wait for their peak velocity, they have a certain velocity profile. So once they reach a peak velocity, they're kind of halfway through. You know what their amplitude will be. So you have their direction already, you're halfway through, you have a prediction of their amplitude. And that gives you, depending on the saccade size, about a degree of accuracy halfway through the saccade. Of course, the longer you wait, the better your prediction gets, but now your lag is shorter. Am I making any sense? Right. So before he makes a saccade, I have no idea where it's going to go. As soon as he initiates it, I know the direction, but I don't have a good idea of the amplitude. When it reaches the velocity peak, I have a pretty good idea of the amplitude. And then when it ends, well, I know where it went because he's already there.
So right. You have a little program that...
Oh, yeah. So this is all computed online generated, working on sub-millisecond range. Every millisecond, a data sample from the eyes is coming in. So this is done with an eye coil, which is sampling at a 1 kilohertz sampling rate. So I get an eye sample every millisecond.
So you
and
measure with some sort of electronics both the direction of the saccade and the velocity of the eye.
That's right. I measure actually the position and then convert to those variables. Exactly right. Sorry, I should have said that. But so you had to write some computer code. It's running all in real time to do all this. And psychophysicists have done similar tricks in reading and so forth. So we weren't the first to do those kind of tricks. It's just the first to do it in this context.
And you decide randomly if you want to put the target.
Right. I set a probability. And actually, I said only for saccades of a certain length could I actually insert them. And then there's
chance.
And then above that, it was chance, right? So, you know, he could go for a long time before he got something, or he could go for only one trial. So it was random. A mean of about, I think it was about 5 saccades for trial before a target appeared. 5 of the large saccade. So now we'll look at some data. So the question was, are the neural responses any different in these cases? So after we've done all that, now we can compare control versus free viewing. This is just like the slide I showed you earlier. This is a target selective neuron, except this neuron responds quite well to both of these two target stimuli and not to these two. So it could be used to do a discrimination in some sort of population code to say it's one of these two, but not those two. You can see here the trial rasters that I showed you earlier. Each row is a different trial. The neuron, nice response, very reproducible to these two targets. It's beginning slightly earlier than the one I showed you. Well, actually about the same, about 150 milliseconds. These are the spike histograms. This is controlled viewing. Here are this is the animal's reaction time range that I also showed you earlier. And so now, it is target selective, but it's different. It's not coding just one single target. It would be a pretty, if you had several neurons like this, you could have a population code that could distinguish this, right? There's information about identity here, and it's target selective in the sense that an ANOVA would say, there's a difference. These rates aren't all the same mean rate here within this time window that I'm analyzing. It was more responsive to one, but when I showed you those 30% numbers, this would be in there, and so would that previous one. Anything where it would pass, it would be significant by an ANOVA. In other words, the response isn't all the same in all four conditions.
So here are the time of onset. Here it was the yellow bar before. Here it's longer. Before the yellow bar.
Yeah, that's just a problem that I told you. It was kind of cut off by the end of the trial there. So this is the time of the onset, and the plot is ending here. I'll show you the full distributions at the end. This is about the end of it. That's why the other ones were a little shorter. That graph, I think, only went out to like 350 milliseconds or something like that.
It's 20 hertz.
Yeah, well, again, I don't know if that's background or what it's responding to, the gray screen or the... Right, he could be building up, and we do see some neurons like that. He knows something's going to happen here. But now I'll show you the free viewing. So the free viewing, these were interleaved. So he'd run 100 of those control viewing trials, then he'd run 100 of the free viewing. Then he'd run, so he'd alternate back and forth about 5 times between controlled and free viewing. And some of you have already seen this. So this is what happens in free viewing. So you can see this neuron still responds very well to these two targets. The neural latency and the amplitude are very similar and responds very poorly to these two targets, the same. So this neuron seems to have very little effect of free viewing. Some people have pointed out, well, there might be a little dip here, but I think that's, it's not a consistent feature. Sorry?
Very early in time for this.
If you think there's some top-down effect of like, he knows he's going to make a movement. Some part of his brain knows he's going to make a movement. It could be, it could precede the saccade in theory if that was an eye movement.
But it's selected to the top.
I know. That's why I don't make much out of this, but people have pointed this out. And when you see the population average, you'll see that it doesn't exist in the average. So it's not a strong effect across neurons. I think that's just a chance happening for that particular run. So the point I really like to make from this neuron is it doesn't look like there's much of an effect on the neural response. So those two conditions, even though you've got all these differences, when you equate right here, everything's equal on the retina, and the neuron's exactly the same. So you can view it almost as like a feed-forward filter. When things are the same on the retina, the response is the same, and it's selective. Okay, that's at least our interpretation. That was one neuron. This is a population summary. So this is responses to the best target. This is essentially just a graph of responsivity. This is control viewing, and this is free viewing. This is on a log scale. So this is about 117 neurons that were statistically responsive. And you see that points are mostly along the diagonal line, which means that they're equally responsive to controlled viewing and free viewing. It's not like they've gotten more suppressed or excited by free viewing. There are a few neurons that seem to have a bit of an exception that, in general, when they were found to have some differences here, this was less than 10% of the neurons, but when we did find effects, they tended to be slightly weaker responses in the free viewing versus control viewing. And that is a kind of thing that you'd predict from one of the differences, which I maybe didn't point out, which is that he's looking at lots of different distractors, so he might have some adaptation to the response, that then when he hits the target, the response is kind of weaker. But that's just conjecture.
So this is the peak of the histogram?
Yes, so that, I'm sorry. So now that I'm doing summary rates, what I'm taking is an average over this window we talked about. It starts at 100 and ends at about 250 milliseconds or 200 milliseconds. It doesn't really matter. We can choose any of those windows.
And you get
it's not the peak, it's the, it's an integration over about 100 milliseconds.
This one, which was the preferred target? I mean, because
Yeah. Well, you know what? So how did I actually pick it in the? So I think I preferred I averaged over both conditions, and then so there wouldn't be bias. And I don't know in this case. I think it was this one. And that's why it's on the front here. But it's hard to say in this case.
It could change between the free and the control, a little bit.
Right, that because it could change, and so if you picked it based on the control or R based on the free, that would bias the, you know. So what you really need is an independent test of best and worst, and then run the free and control. But the closer thing we could do to that is to either divide the trials in halves. It doesn't really matter, you get the same thing.
Did you see any systematic differences between targets 1, 2, and 3 and 4? Because 1, 2 have an extra symmetry that the distractor didn't have.
So you're now asking about the population, and if I looked at kind of the pattern of selectivity. Yeah, so other people have mentioned that too, and said there's some mathematical difference here between these, and yeah, I think that's kind of what you're saying. And I mean,
the distractor was like 3 and 4.
Yeah, the distractor, the top of it was kind of like this, but the bottom was like this or like that.
But here you have only left-right symmetry, you have left-right, and here you have all of up and down.
Yeah, that's true, right. So maybe we could talk afterwards. You suggest a good analysis to do for this, but I haven't looked at anything like that. Okay, so... Now I'm going to just, this is the overall effect of free viewing on both responsivity and selectivity. Here I've just, to summarize by plotting the population average, this is among target selective neurons. So they're target selective, and then I rank order their responses before they get averaged in. So this is the response to the best target, and this is the response to the worst target. Now, so you can see that this plot, so for control viewing, there's a slope to this plot. Well, that's got to be true because I selected them to be target selective, and then I rank ordered them. So what you can make from this is just the degree of selectivity. So this is kind of like those third of neurons that I was talking about. You can see that it's about 3-to-1 selectivity. This is a normalized spike rate, so normalized to the average. To give you a sense, this is about a 30 spike per second difference on average between best and worst. And this just says that we've got good selectivity, 3-to-1 selectivity. And the thing to point out is that in controlled and free viewing, the average selectivity is nearly identical. And there's a slight reduction in responsivity, which you could kind of see on the last slide. But that amounts to only about 1.9 spikes per second. So we don't think that's a big, huge effect. So the summary is that... this one?
Yeah.
So this is, you could think of this as spike rate or average spike rate for the population. Remember, this is 63 neurons averaged together. And they all have different response rates. Some fire at 60 spikes, some at 40. And if you don't weight them, if we just average them together, then we get an overweighting of the neurons that have higher rates. And it's not clear in what's the right thing to do. And we did it both ways and you get essentially the same plot. But so this is the normalized plot, and each neuron you take its average rate, divide by that, and so now it's moving from its averaged rate to like of all four or something. But you could do it to the best or the worst, or you know, that just changes the weighting slightly, and so the weighting doesn't really matter. It's just some people get worried that, oh, you're only showing the effect of two really responsive neurons, and most of them aren't that way. This all the neurons are counting equally, but it doesn't matter. You do either way and you get the same plot. We also looked at the time course because we thought, well, maybe there are effects in time, and because I'm looking at this window of 100-150 milliseconds that I'm missing something. So this is an average population time course for those same 63 neurons. Blue is controlled, red is free viewing. Okay, so these distributions are the reaction time distributions we keep talking about, and you know their widths and how long are they. You can see he's actually slightly slower in free viewing on average than control, but the earliest... Sorry?
I would say much slower, no? I mean, with this,
yeah.
It is a very fast movement.
50 to 100 slower.
Yeah. The whole saccade is, this is a very...
Right, fast. I mean, it's definitely a real effect. I mean, there's no... So, what you could look at this as well, free, and well, here are the neural responses, right? And you can see they're very similar. This is the best target and the worst target. So you can get a sense of when the selectivity occurs, and it's similar in both conditions, and the peak response is similar, and the time course is similar. But so the neural responses are very similar, even though you could might argue that the behavior is, I mean, he's doing the same response, but he's taking longer to do it. But it's not as if you might say, well, IT has shifted out here for free viewing. And so whatever is causing the slowdown doesn't seem to be IT. And I think Alex and I were talking about.
Yeah, what causes this slowdown?
Well, that's a great question, right? So we're recording from the, if we record from the motor neurons, they should be locked to this, right? And but you know, is IT sensory or motor? Well, it looks to be sensory, because if you look at trial by trial correlation, it's very locked to the stimulus, poorly locked to the response. So something intervenes between these responses. If, again, with all the caveats, is IT involved and all those which we talked about earlier, something intervenes to cause a delay, which is apparently to us random. We can't.
Behaviorally speaking, it's strange, because you would expect, because of the previous history of movements, that there will be a delay in the processing time, because it just got there and you have this saccadic inhibition or whatever. But there's no delay in the processing time.
Right, well, I mean, it's like the processing time is tuned to the saccade duration, and it's able to keep up. And that, it makes a lot of sense, right? You want to make your machine move at a rate which it can actually do the complete the processing before it starts the next one, or at least have the processing in the pipeline while it's beginning the next saccade. Right, so it, some neurons actually respond very well to the distractor, and you can see them going up and down with the kind of 200 millisecond response period, just like you'd say. So it's almost like IT is just every saccade is offering up what's out there, what's out there, what's out there, and just can keep up with these eye movements. And I think sometimes it says target, or somebody says target, and there's a signal to hold. And then, but then how, what causes the delay to reaction time? I mean, these are all often areas that we don't know. We're recording in front of live fields now to look to see if we see the same thing.
On the other hand, in the case of the free motion, then the response is connected also to the saccade movement that he made in between.
Right, so you...
So it could be that, for instance, the next saccade has a tendency to go in the same direction as the previous one, and then that would confuse the animal in making the decision. Whereas in the controlled situation, you are always fixed and...
Right, so, yeah, so there could be, I think you're kind of saying, well, we're kind of tying up the motor response machinery a bit in the free viewing case, and it may need time to recover even though IT doesn't. I think that's right. I mean, the data are consistent with that hypothesis.
You know, taking back this point of the pathways, which pathway is responsible for the response, and you mentioned the possibility to make the trial-by-trial correlation of response in IT and movement. So actually here one has to admit that you have a response which you shouldn't like here, because you don't have a correlation between the timing of response in IT and the timing of motor.
Well, you can't tell the trial by trial from these plots.
No, even but, the average doesn't. I mean, you have very non-correlated or what
you mean. Right, I mean, ignore the free viewing.
See, but it's, here, it's exactly what you don't have.
The average, all you're saying is between free and control, there's no correlation, right, on average, which is already strong evidence that you might not see a correlation when you look, say, just at control, which is something we talked about earlier. And that's exactly the truth, because we've already looked at it. Hundreds of trials collected looking for trial by trial correlation. On almost all of these IT neurons, essentially all of them, we see nothing.
No correlation.
Okay, so up to that point, it's whatever is determining this lag, it's not affecting the latency of IT responses. So that was something
that this might be an indication that maybe relevant, although the processing happening here, but
yeah,
the processing that determines the motor response, maybe you're doing...
Right. We talked about, this is a question of, are these neurons really involved or are they in some dead-end pathway, right? And that's where we have to try to intervene. All the data is consistent with them being on just a kind of sensory filter bank, you know, but I think, I don't know what in parietal you might see something different because it's more motor, but in V1, I mean, certainly you see no trial-by-trial correlation, and no one thinks that's a dead-end pathway, right? So just because there's no trial-by-trial correlation just means, right, I mean, not proof either way, but it kind of says, well, you might want to worry about this a bit more, which is what you're saying, and I agree.
In the control case, did the target appear at fixed time after the fixation point?
Yes, he did. So he had knowledge of it, anticipation.
Anticipated in that case, in the
yeah.
case, he didn't know.
Right, so again, he could have primed up his motor machinery here, tied up his motor machinery here, and that could explain everything. But in all we're looking at is IT, and nothing's different. We included that difference purposefully because we wanted to see if it had an effect on IT, and it didn't seem to. There were a few neurons that seemed to, even in IT, that built up before the response. And those were the ones that showed up on the plot that I showed you, a few percent that where we saw effects. They seemed to be effects that were not really stimulus-driven, but where it seemed to be kind of anticipation-type effects. That would be the strongest effect that I saw differences between controlled and free viewing on the few neurons where we did see effects. I mean, that's a really good point. Is the monkey more likely to keep going the way?
Is he more likely to keep going right if you just come out right, or is the 200 milliseconds that he's studying the target long enough for him to forget which direction he's coming from?
I haven't done an analysis of that, but given that, you know, it's hard to do because he's got the constraints of he knows the physical world. So if he's over here, he just moved right, but now he's got less space over there. So is he more? He's actually, I think, going to be more likely to move back into the middle. But that doesn't mean that what you're saying isn't true. So there's multiple constraints on the animal. There's the world, and then there's what he just did. So you're asking in our particular data. I think if I analyze it, I'd find he was actually more likely to reverse direction.
If he was
torn the boundary, yeah, and with enough,
he's at the center.
Yeah, if he's at the center, right. So you screen out enough saccades, you could probably get him unbiased. He's at the center, and he came from the left or came from the right. In which way is he more likely to move? I don't know the answer to that. I think we looked at that at one point, but I can't remember. Sorry, Alex. Did you have a question? No. Okay. Okay. Let me just summarize this part of the results section. So we did all that manipulation so we're able to get accurate and reproducible retinal stimulation even in these free-viewing animals. So we could really ask, well, now we've got identical retinal stimulation, how much of an effect can we get? And in fact, statistically, 90% of the neurons were unaffected. I told you about a few shoe neurons that were affected, seemed to be mostly anticipation effects. Mostly they were unaffected. And if you look at the overall population average, which I just showed you two slides of, there is virtually no effect. And so we conclude from all this that the IT representations that like support recognition seem to be largely unaffected by free viewing. It's as if, I mean, as I think has come out, as if IT just offers up a representation of what's on the retina, a nice extracted representation in terms of recognition, but it doesn't seem to be very sensitive to things like, well, the eyes were moving and the eyes weren't moving, which makes a whole lot of sense if you were going to have a recognition kind of machine. And this also says that other studies like the Grow study, where they weren't doing free viewing, or Kobataki, or almost every other study where there's mostly passively viewing animals, says that those data are still valid in some sense in terms of their stimulus selectivities and responsivity, because we don't see a big effect of free viewing. So all that other data work doesn't have to be redone in a sense. So that this is essentially a null result, but it clarifies some issues in the field that were being kicked around, that there might be strong effects of this. There may be effects, but they're not very strong, at least not in IT. That's a summary of that. So now I'm going to go on to the last section, unless there's any questions.
Before we go to the last section, can you say something about this paper by
Scheinberg and Logan?
Yeah,
I thought you might wonder about that.
So, how you see it.
So David,
want to summarize briefly.
David Scheinberg and Nikos Logothetis did a free viewing study, which was it was like what I had said that people have done, which is he put up a stimulus, a big array, and it told the animal to go find something, and he taught the animal a set of objects, and the animal would go around, and this is like a real world image, you know, this is like a Where's Waldo, or, you know, kind of like the image I showed you, color and everything. And so the animal would make lots of eye movements trying to find the stimulus, and then it would find it and get near it enough or close to it, and then it would make a response to it. And then he compared that, or they compared it with conditions where the stimulus was on an isolated background. And they just presented, and I think the animal would find it quickly and then go and make the same response.
They trained the animal to a particular stimuli.
To a particular group of stimuli.
Which kind of stimuli?
They were all kinds of things. One of them was a picture of Waldo, one of them was a butterfly, you know, a star. And I think it was one group was press the left button, and if you see any of this other group, press the right button. So I think that was the basic design. So it didn't have the response mapping I had. But I mean, that was a similar idea, as a recognition task. And the problem, so what they reported in terms of responsivity and selectivity is essentially what I've showed you here. But if you look at their data, it's a bit, you know, it's a bit muddy. It's not exactly clear that there's not effects of this clutter and so forth. And part of the problem is I can't compare their, they don't have a nice way to compare, to say the retinal conditions are identical, because as I said, the animal would get near it sometimes, directly on it other times. And so there's a little bit of a, the retinal control is different in that case. But it's nicer in that it's a natural scene. Okay, so I think those results of theirs are consistent with ours, but are just a bit muddier because of the lack of retinal control.
What are the results?
So essentially that if they look at selectivity, that it didn't matter whether it was in clutter or not. And responsivity, kind of the same things that I've showed you. It didn't matter whether the animal was doing this free viewing in the clutter versus not. That was the overall average result that I pulled from the first part of their paper. I don't know, is that consistent with what you think?
Yeah.
Okay, so that was consistent with ours. The interesting thing about their... I'm going to go on to the second part, right? Is that what you want to hear about?
No, I want to just say their clutter was more clutter.
Right, so it was nicer in that sense, right?
Well,
so
I'm not saying nicer.
Right, but it was a real-world scene, so it was real clutter.
And did they find no difference?
Well, it's hard to say no difference. There were differences, but was that a retinal difference or was that a clutter, right? How do you tell? To disentangle that is very hard.
Neurons were less selective.
Well, they, you know, a neuron that liked something still liked it when it was in clutter. That's one way to put the data, right?
The message is that it's okay. We are now arguing how much.
Yeah, then it becomes a quantitative issue, and then you need tricks to. So the interesting result they did have, though, at the very last figure of that paper, they showed that, okay, so the animal's doing this Where's Waldo search, and, you know, say the target is here, and the animal comes to this point. Sometimes he goes there, finds it, makes a response. Sometimes he starts going off this way, like he didn't notice it. And if they compare responses in those two cases in IT, they get much stronger responses when he goes than when he doesn't. So they call this the noticing effect, or the paper was something titled about noticing. And they did it, of course, they couldn't get this reproducible condition that I'm drawing for you here. This would happen on one trial, another trial he'd be over here, another trial, you know, who knows where he'd be because of all the problems with the freebieing, the way the freebieing was done. But they did kind of a, well, if he was in a range of around 2 degrees, then we could compare this. And they show this strong effect. And so that's a really interesting result, because it seemed very strong. And so,
can you say the game?
Oh. So the noticing effect is whether you move to a target or don't move to the target from approximately the same distance with an average of all kinds of different colors, averaged over all their conditions. You know, you can't, the conditions are not equal, retinal conditions. What you want is him here on 100 trials, 50 of them moving here on 100 trials, 50 of them moving away. Right? All the retinal conditions are the same, and it's only the choice that differs. But they didn't have that, right? They had a whole mix of conditions, a whole mix of positions, and they had, so they kind of got an average effect. You have to have all that stuff in there. Does that make sense? And so stronger responses when you go here, almost no response. So this is a neuron that likes this object. Okay, so stronger responses when you move to the object, weak responses. So that kind of fits with, oh, it's noticed, and now the neuron responds, and that's what drives the behavior. And it's neat, and it's inconsistent with what I've been saying. Our data, they seem to be always responding. But I haven't told you anything about error trials, which was what I'd call that as an error trial. So I broke down our free viewing trials looking for this effect. So someone asked us, so sometimes on the free viewing, he actually moves, you know. So I didn't tell you this, but I was presenting them always at the center of gaze for what I've told you about so far. I also presented them to the left and right of center of gaze, which is what I'm going to tell you about next. So during free viewing, he comes and I present a target to the left. Sometimes he hops to the left and then he says, oh, I saw it, and makes a response. Other times he goes off somewhere else, right? So now it's the same conditions. There's a target there. Sometimes he gets it, sometimes he doesn't. But we weren't looking for this effect, so this happens very rarely. He's very good at this, right? So only, you know, 5% of trials or less does he actually miss this target. Okay, but we can still grab those trials, look at selective neurons, and see, do we see this effect? And we've got identical retinal conditions because we forced them, right? And we don't see the effect. So, the effect I just told you about, the noticing effect.
Yeah, but what?
So we see equal responsivity in both cases. So
with intracellular, with extracellular.
Extracellular.
In this region.
Yes, in the same region, you know, it's hard to say exactly the same location.
What about error trials in this experiment, where you put the target exactly?
Oh, in the in direct.
The studio said sometimes it just.
Yeah, and he was wrong or something, yeah, so or he went away. Well, so there are two different types of errors. He was wrong and he moved away, and there are very few moved away, and also very few wrong. Again, he's very good at this task. But if there's a slight effect of that, maybe a 10% reduction, but his effect was so strong. I mean, it was almost black or white if you look
so
at his figure. So
we don't see strong effects.
We don't. If there are, there might be some weak effects in there, but with our conditions, we don't see strong effects. So this is some issue that has to be sorted out. But I would like to see them redo that, or us or someone redo it with a more controlled stimulus, because I could think of stimulus conditions that might have given them what looked like an effect, which was actually a retinal effect.
In that case, it's almost saying when the neuron did not notice this object.
Yes.
The monkey did not receive.
Right, right. And in my case, I'm saying the neurons always notice the object, but sometimes the monkey doesn't. Right. That's something.
Should be very interesting to record in the parietal cortex in the same class and condition to see what's going on there.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I'm not sure where to record though. I mean, just you mean for eye movements or?
Yeah, eye movements, LIP.
So you would say LIP rather than frontal eye field. And we debated, should we go to LIP next or frontal
eye field? Frontal eye field would be the output of
yeah.
The cortex. But if one of the pathways is dead end, then you will not find any correlation to anything. And the other will have correlation to the decision.
Yeah. Right. So we're getting off into, these are all interesting questions about motor response and decision, and which is a whole direction to pursue. But another direction is kind of the one that I started off more interested in and the things Tommy talked about, which is how do these neurons in IT actually get their properties, and are they really invariant? How did they actually solve that initial recognition problem? We're now talking about, well, okay, now they've solved it, but you've still got to route all these motor signals, and how do you do all that, which I agree.
The question is, it might be, I don't know, maybe for different tasks, the monkey uses different pathways in them.
Yes.
So this specific task. I mean, this is what they have to do in life, as we said before. So
right.
He can invest all his parietal system to this, or all his.
Right.
It could be just a random choice, even just by starting the training. I mean, it does turn out to be this or that.
Yeah. Well, I guess you're right. If we were going to follow this and figure out where the motor responses are initiated, we have to probably go up to parietal eventually. And I guess what I'm saying is my plan or goal is to really understand how invariance is achieved, and that seems to be more strong in IT. But we're kind of doing both at the moment. We're off in frontal eye field. That may lead back to parietal, but I also have this interest which is more related to these invariance issues, which is my major thrust at the moment. So I started all this by saying, well, recognition is fascinating, and the really hard problem is invariance. Now, I agree there's interesting problems about motor mapping and decision, and that's fascinating from a kind of cognitive sense. But computationally, the problem for recognition is the invariance problem, and that's what I'm going to talk about now. So again, just to remind you, this is another way of looking at the recognition problem. Here's a sensory image again. So you could imagine, to recognize this, you just build a template. This is like drawing those circles around those objects I showed you earlier. Of course, I go through this quickly because you already all know this. The problem is that, of course, as you remove the stimuli around, then the template model fails miserably for things like size changes and position changes and orientation. And so you have to have a template at some point, some sort of memory of this. But we think it's in a form of representation which is not a pixel-based one like this. And so that's the question, what is the form of representation and how do you achieve such a nice representation that's invariant to things like position and size? And just to summarize the type of variables that you need to be invariant to in recognition, the things that can change the object, the retinal image without altering the object identity, there are things Tommy already went through. Position, size, and orientation in the viewing plane, these are the 2D affine changes in the image. And also the things that Tommy focused on, view and illumination. And also I'd throw in here things like clutter and occlusion. All of these alter the retinal image that the object presents, but you can still identify the object in the face of changes in all these variables. And that's the hard problem in recognition. And theorists have known this for a long time. There are a lot of models out there how it could work. Tommy's responsible for a lot of them. But no one knows which model is actually implemented in the brain and how the brain solves each of these things. And it could be that it solves each of them in a different way, that you know these are dealt with, since they're 2D affine, you could build in some transformation that would always compensate for them, whereas some of this would have to be learned and be more instance-based like the model Tommy was talking about. But we don't know how the brain actually solves these problems. And so that's essentially the goal, is to understand how the brain deals with these. I'm just going to tell you data we've collected on position invariance, which I chose because it was a very simple thing. I thought it was almost magic that in IT it had been reported that neurons were position invariant has been kicked around here, and I'll show you some slides. And I really wanted to see how position invariant are they, and so we could document that and maybe figure out how to get they get to be position invariant. Although computationally it's one of the simplest, it seemed like a good baseline place to start. So that's why I started there. And I'll show you that data. So let me give you a sense first of what position invariance really means. If you fixate the red dot and just tell me what you see. Okay, so if you were fixating, you probably still could identify three letters. So your letter recognition over this range is largely position invariant then. That's just a simple demonstration that you can do such a thing. So how does the brain do this? Well, the idea that we've been talking about, as I've said, is IT neurons are known to have very large receptive fields. So this is the temporal lobe. You know, the rest of the brain would be like this. This is from Kobitaki. This is their map of a receptive field maps of penetrations in different areas. We said selectivity increases. Receptive field size also increases. Here's a scale bar here, 10 degrees. You can see that out here in anterior IT, this crosses, say, the fovea, and each of the boxes is a different neuron. These are mapped with, I think, somewhat optimal stimuli that they tried to get using their reduction method I showed you earlier. But you can see that this is a 40-degree receptive field that easily includes the fovea in both sides. You know, here these are 10 or 20 degrees. All these anterior eye fields are big, 10 or 20 degrees. I think Gross early on reported a median size of 20 degrees in IT, anterior IT. More recent studies, more detailed studies have reported median sizes a little smaller, more like 10 to 15 degrees. But certainly the order of magnitude is pretty large. And so the idea is that these fields might support position and size invariant recognition. Now this just says the neuron's responsive in these regions. It doesn't say anything about invariance and how well it can continue to code the object identity over changes in things like position and size. So this is one study that's often cited by some theorists on position invariance. This is Tove et al. 1994. These bars are neural responses. The radius here, you can't read it. That's about 50 spikes per second. These are neural responses to an optimal face stimulus. This is a face selective neuron presented either directly at the center of the gaze, 11 degrees in any of these four directions. You see the neuron just continues to love this face, even though it's moved by 11 degrees. And this is a face it doesn't like, and you may show, well, it doesn't like this one. So this neuron might be able to distinguish between these two faces over changes of at least 11 degrees. I think it was held on for 200 milliseconds or maybe longer. I don't remember the details. Well, anomaly. This is a passively viewing animal, not doing a recognition task, just fixating. They figure out the best face, and then they put the face up. Put the face up here. Put the face up here. The animal's still fixating the point. Yeah, he doesn't get to move out there, for instance, right? Okay, so this is the kind of, you know, this is all consistent with everybody saying, well, there's invariance. And I always, as a graduate student, found this fascinating because I said, well, it's kind of done the problem, right? At least for position. I mean, the mapping problem that I've identified for you earlier on, if you could figure out how this neuron did it, well, you've done it. You've got all these hard things left, like motor mapping and things we've been talking about, but everything must have happened up to here. And so the answer for recognition, at least as I framed it, is somewhere up here, at least for position invariance. So I found this fascinating. And I don't remember for that one. It was probably, you know, obviously at least that big. And I should point out, for those of you who don't know, receptive field mapping is a very vague thing, right? It depends on the exact stimulus that you use. The field could change, right? Obviously, if they use that stimulus to map the field is smaller, non-existent. If they use this stimulus, it's very big, right? And so in IT, that problem is especially bad because of this issue, whereas in V1 or LGN, you can kind of say, well, small dot of light or a bar is okay. But so when I give you the size, I don't even know for this. I'd say, well, look, it's at least, you know, plus or minus 11 degrees, probably bigger. But it's even this is somewhat arbitrary. I mean, that's part of the point of all this is we don't really know. I mean, receptive field mapping isn't a good summary measure. What you really want is a more quantitative measure of invariance, position invariance, if that's what you're interested in. I was just saying receptive field suggested that. That's why I said these might. You know, this is kind of the long-standing hypothesis. We know that you map these, they're big. That might support invariance. Here's some data on invariance. And that's kind of how the story starts.
I think most of these
so to speak, data were kind of anecdotal ones.
Anecdotal. The position invariance data, you mean, Tommy?
People have reported starting, I guess, with Charlie Gross.
And
these neurons were at a big receptive field, like 40 degrees, and were invariant.
Right.
They never really tested in a quantitative way for specificity.
That's right.
To just response. So it was, and this, you know, I'm not sure how much, this was one monkey, one experiment.
Yes, right. And that's probably like their best neuron, and right, so.
It was a kind of open question, apart from
Nichols,
I guess.
Yes.
But wouldn't be enough to see just one neuron does it, and then you know that this neuron at least solved the problem.
Yeah, if you believe the experiment.
If you believe the experiment, yeah, but the fact that it's just one neuron.
Yeah, I agree with you on that one.
Right. This is, I think, the best study so far, which again is Logothetis study in 1995. I think Tommy was actually on this study. With John Pauls. This is the paperclip study that Tommy showed you, and they trained, he actually showed this graph, I think. So they trained animals to identify paperclips at different views, and that was the major focus of the study. But for a few neurons, I think it was a small number, 10 or so, they tested things like the effect of size and the effect of changes in position. And the nice thing they did, which I really like, is they had a measure of what Tommy's referring to as selectivity. So it wasn't just does the neuron continue to respond, but they did how well does it respond relative to the mean of its best distractor, the response of its best distractor. So that would tell you how much it maintains its selectivity over changes in size. Of course, I think the best distractor was always at a standard size. What you really want is against like all possible distractors of all sizes, maybe. But it's still much better than, say, something like this. And they did, here's various sizes in degrees, 1.9 to 5.6. So one would be no selectivity. So this neuron is 5 times more responsive than its best to its best target than it is to its best distractor over these, threefold change in size. And here's position. So they had a center, and they did the four corners just like here. But now it's only 2.25 degrees. So there's much smaller changes than here. But they still showed, it's pretty good. It was out to 2.2. But they said, and for their study, it looked like it cut off by 7. That out at 7 degrees, neuron was not invariant anymore, which seems different than this. So already there's a lot of, there's almost order of magnitude difference between what you might see. This is the smallest degree of invariance that had been reported. And it was also the study where the animal was really trained, probably mostly at the phobia. So that might be a little hint, I think. But again, they didn't have very good eye control here because they weren't really worried about this issue, I think. But this is the best data out there on position invariance for a specific set of objects.
The other data were mostly on faces, I guess.
Well, faces and Tanaka had a study where it was complex things.
These are usually single units or
multi units?
These are codes.
It's nominally single units. Okay, so there was, there's suggestion of position invariance. There does seem to be some position invariance. So the idea is that, okay, you've got this IT receptive field, and if you're trying to identify A, this is an A neuron, and wherever you put the neuron should continue to respond, right? And that's how you can do the position task that I showed you earlier. Okay, so again, this is magic to me, right? Somehow it did it. How did it do it? Did it, slide this around in your brain or something like that? I mean, that's the recognition question. What's the model that achieves that? Tommy could talk more about that. But so we just said, given that, let's look at our neurons and let's look at position invariance. And we thought we were well set up to just get some preliminary data. And in our task, the animal, we taught him to recognize the objects not only at the center, which I showed you mostly so far, but also at the 1.5 degrees to the left and to the right. This is 1.5 degrees, okay? That's like the width of your thumb off the side, okay? So I don't know. This is an imaginary IT field of, 6 degrees. I told you that they're supposed to be 20 or something, but there's some issues of the discriminability of the stimuli, which are going to limit things. You can't be position invariant out forever. I mean, obviously, I told you couldn't even see the stimuli out here, so. Not clear where to draw that line, but the suggestion was the field should be very big, so they should at least contain the stimuli that we put in here. That's what we thought. So the first issue, this is way back to the earlier talk, first you want to measure behavior, right? How invariant is the behavior? And so this is two animals, monkey one, monkey two. They were both very accurate and very fast at all positions. So this is their percent correct at all three positions. Remember, they're four stimuli, so this is chance if he just starts guessing. And you can see that both of them were between about 80 and 95% correct across all three positions. And they were actually equally fast, around 300 milliseconds, or between 250 and 300, as I've been saying, in all three positions. Okay, so the animal, as far as we can tell, it has a nice invariant recognition over this small change, okay, which isn't too surprising. But then what was surprising is that when we looked at a lot of these neurons, so these are target selective neurons. Now I'm coding target by color just so you can see it better here because they're all overlapped. This neuron responds well to these two targets, not to these two. I think this was the same neuron I showed earlier that we talked about. You see that this neuron responds very well in targets at the center of gaze, but when they're only 1.5 degrees away, there's a neuron, no response, right? So this neuron at least, and lots of others that I'll show you, is not a position invariant neuron. Even though the animal's got behavior off across all this range and beyond, this neuron can only seem to support recognition in this central position. And you say, well, you know, there should be other neurons to do this, or else again we're in the wrong brain area. But we did find other neurons that seem to have, you know, even complementary patterns of results. So this neuron seemed to like targets out here, and which is contralateral, and also targets out here in ipsilateral, tiny response in the center, still having selectivity out in those positions.
It's really tough for the mind to explain how the neurons change the selectivity if you change position, but behavior of course doesn't.
Well, so you could imagine pooling these two groups of neurons together. Yeah, so if you had an...
Okay, but if you count on these neurons to make the computation...
But don't count on one.
What?
You don't count on one.
You don't count on this one.
What? Count on double.
No, but if there are enough like this that change the selectivity, I don't know how many...
Well, they don't change their selectivity. They're only selective in a certain regions of space, right?
You can only change the selectivity, you know.
Well, it goes to zero.
Yellow one here, for no one here, for all...
Right, so it goes to zero. So you could view it as a selectivity with a very small receptive field.
No, but you present the stimulus. Now, this neuron, at one position, will respond to this stimulus.
Yes.
At another position, will not.
Not.
Now, the readout signal that has to interpret what was the stimulus should know when to rely on this neuron.
Well, right, so this is, you take it back to the complex cell, right? It's the same model, right? The simple cell, one will respond here, one will respond here, but the complex cell is somehow able to respond over all positions.
It's not the same.
Well, no, but I'm saying you could have a higher neuron off of these neurons, or you could have these driving the motor neurons directly, and you never have a truly invariant neuron. You don't really need them.
No, but I'm saying this one is a confusing neuron. It's not an invariant neuron.
Well, it's not invariant, but it still could contribute to the task. I think that's what everybody's saying.
If the readout circuit rely on this neuron, it should be confused. Right? Well,
you know, neuron can just pull from all of them. You have a neuron which only cares about this position, other neuron cares about this position.
Don't rely on this neuron.
If it was silent, there.
It is silent in the middle.
But it's not silent at minus 1.5. Yeah. Oh, the yellow one is not silent.
So it doesn't contribute to the middle, it contributes to the middle.
Yellow one, would you call it responsive? I mean,
well, you have to do a statistical test. I don't know. We'll take this one.
No,
here's
this. Is this. No, no, but here you call it responsive, and here, the left side. Here in the middle, take the yellow curve in the middle. You call it a response.
Yeah.
Now go to the next slide. Look at the left. Would you call the yellow one a response?
It's a response. Who's saying it's not a response? I'm not saying it's not a response.
Okay, it is a response.
Yes, that's probably a response too. It's just.
I'm saying, in one condition, this neuron will respond to all four shapes. In the other position, it responds to all one.
Oh, because you're looking at these, right?
Yeah.
You're saying, well, so this isn't a. So if you were like going to set a threshold and say, the only way you could get anything out of this neuron, you know, from those measures, if you did that logothetis measure, this neuron isn't going to pass that invariance test very well at all. I think that's what you're saying. It's hard to take this kind of neuron and say, well, How is it invariant? What you want is a neuron that keeps responding yellow and low level for all three, which is what that logothetis study was implying.
Or it only fires at one consistent, it fires at one position.
Or one position.
Shadow for the others.
Yes, but that's still not a position invariant neuron. But I mean,
no, then it's not a position invariant. But then you can say, okay, the next one will make an old function of all bits. Then you can solve the problem. But I'm saying here, it's very hard to solve the problem.
But when you look at it, I mean, before, let's say, it is so complicated to get an invariant neuron. And now you see one that is not invariant. Of course, that is easy.
It's very simple.
It's confusing, the issue.
No, it's very simple to get an invariant neuron, like the complex, simple example. Here, many neurons, each one is localized to its own location. Then you make an all function of all of them. Just sum them all. Right. With a simple all function, you get the invariant neuron. This is easy task, right? It's not complex.
Yeah, but when you get stimuli like it's very complex, you know, it gets difficult. I mean, there's some
so the complexity is for each one of them to solve the identification for its own position.
Yeah.
But to get the invariance is not complex. It's very simple. Once you got the identification problem per position, and you have many of them, then just make an O function.
Right. Well, I agree. But my impression of IT was that I was supposed to find neurons that had invariant responses over, you know, 5 or 6 degrees at least, and most of them seem to be more like this. So.
Saying this poses a serious problem. Okay, we can discuss it later. This poses a serious problem for
What's the 0.6 degrees, which is right important. Yeah, so there's some, that's a good point. I mean, Tommy points this out too. I mean, these neurons are not completely, I mean, I showed you, well, let's show you some more examples. Oops, so here's a neuron. Well, so this one responds only in the center, not on the sides. These ones prefer the center. Here's the same thing. But so this one, okay, it's still responding a little out here. But so, and it's still got selectivity, so it's got invariance over 3 degrees. So it's not, there's nothing's been done, and this is a template model. You know, this is still some range of invariance. It's just much smaller than we expected. So this is becoming a quantitative issue. I mean, for instance, out here, still responding selectively out there. Although I think your point is that, well, if you did the logothetis thing, right, none of these neurons are gonna pass. Right, because look, that point's below that point. So if the response is at, you know, this level, do I say it's the red one in the center or the blue one on the side? Right. So these neurons aren't invariant by that definition. And here's some that like the side, which also aren't invariant by that definition. But then we found a few. There are a few that look like this, right? Which is what we're supposed to find.
What's the numbers?
Well, okay, so. I think it's hard because this is a continuum, and I'm showing you points in the continuum. This is a summary that kind of gets at that. Maybe you can glean some of it. So this is, what do I compare it to? I mean, so it's hard because you can't really compare position selectivity with target selectivity. It's a little, you know, apples and oranges mixed things to compare. But people have done this, and usually they show, okay, you got good target selectivity and poor position selectivity. So the measure here is best minus worst target and best minus worst position, just as a kind of crude measure. Is it more sensitive to target position or target identity? And people have done this before, have found that, you know, I think that's from the same role study, that the neurons tend to lie down here. They don't get a lot of effective position, but they really are coding information about target. Okay, so they would be, you know, so that neuron is probably one of the ones I showed you on the bottom there, right? So, you know, there's probably a couple in here that I pulled out to get that in the bottom. But most of them kind of are more, the neurons I showed you at the top would be kind of along the diagonal. They say, well, there's strong effects here, but there are also strong effects of target. Right, so they're kind of comparable selectivity. Well, again, this is our, we could do that. It depends on, well, that neuron we showed earlier where they were like two versus didn't like one, that still seems to be carrying target information, but if you did best minus second best, it would say it isn't carrying any target information. It's not clear. Probably the best measure is something like an ANOVA, you know, a measure of variance or something like that, which is what the ANOVA tests, to test overall four stimuli, because we don't know what's being extracted from them, so we don't know what the right thing to plot is down here. I mean, what we want is some measure of what the next stage is using. Is it, you know, does it have some notion of what this neuron does for its worst? And it's we don't know. I mean, we could plot all those things. I think the result would be similar here.
So
So you have 140 neurons, and for each of them, you know, response to each of the target
in each position.
So you can ask yourself, if really based on this information, the monkey can extract the identity of the stimulus environment. And I guess there is a lot of information.
The answer is yes. Well,
the neuron doesn't have to be.
Right, well,
overall, they should provide enough information.
Yes, and I think they do. And then there's a question, you play the numbers game, right? Well, do I need 100? Do I need 50? Do I need another 100 that look like this? But certainly, the answer is yes. I mean, I showed you from the examples, you could kind of tell. But so the important issue is kind of how are they coding the information in IT? And they don't seem to be coding it in the way that maybe naively I thought they would, which is that they mostly look like those ones at the bottom. They seem to be coding it, they've almost like they've kind of tiled the space a bit, like someone said, well, you know, some neurons are...
Another part of IT, IT is big, right?
Well, yeah, but we're already at anterior. We found a few, maybe those nice few we found are getting input from the ones that are tiling the regions of position. But we were surprised to find this degree lack of invariance. I mean, there's some invariance, but it's not the orders of magnitude that we expected. But there's still something here. And everything you say is true. But that's kind of the issue. How is the information coded here? And I'll talk about that a bit more.
So your answer was positive. Like, if you take these 140 neurons,
you can
select. Did it right?
Oh, so that's more of a argument based on how many. Let's say I have to make assumptions, right? Well, this one likes this target. Let's assume we have three others that like the other four targets, right? So that neuron can do that position, and then, well, okay, let's take this one.
If you put it into a machine,
So you say take
an algorithm. The question is, will it be confused by the points that we raised before? Will it do it or not?
Well, I'm telling you, I can look at it and pick the right neurons. Whether I can get an algorithm to train it up to find the right neurons, that becomes a kind of modeling issue that I didn't want to get bogged down in. Yeah, I think yes. It's pretty. I mean, I can see the information in here. So, and I mean, can measure it in bits and so forth. And we could, but you know, it would depend on the training algorithm. Maybe some algorithms would get bogged down and say, that's not going to work. But. I think some algorithm could pick it out, but that wasn't a road I wanted to pursue because I could see that it's here.
No, but it could be a project for modeling.
Yeah,
but it's
sure.
A project. I mean, to compare the performance of a machine that takes this data and do whatever it can with it, with the performance of the monkey and see if it can achieve it.
Right.
But even before that, is to explain this discrepancy between what Jim finds and say what Nikos and the other people found.
Yes, this is the show us on Monday that the Nikos data only something like 10% of the neurons were in carrier.
Well, they were tuned, and the ones that were tuned, the ones which were selected to those objects,
right,
were also, at least those that they tested, were in carrier.
Over
a small
few degrees.
Yeah, a few degrees.
Over a few degrees.
Over plus minus 2 degrees.
Okay.
So the question is either, one of the two experiments is wrong, or more likely there is some other explanation, like because they are dealing with different objects, the paradigm is slightly different.
Or maybe the tuning of them selecting, they really focused, essentially found this subset, right? These are the small. That maybe these are the ones that are really involved in the task, and these are some, talked about these issues earlier, right? We need ways of deciding, how are these neurons really tuned to these stimuli, or are they skirts of the response space? And
like that one down there, for it would be definitely Nikos found,
right? Right. Like these.
Relatively high selectivity invariants.
Did Nikos play with the position invariance or with the viewpoint invariance?
Well, the main, as Jim said, the main goal of that was the view.
Uh-huh.
But when they found these view-tuned neurons, they also looked at, for some of them, how position invariant they were, right, and how size invariant they were.
Yeah.
When I spoke the other day, I focused on the size invariant because in the case of Nikos, they controlled eye movements, but I don't think they controlled them as well as Jim did. And if you don't control eye movement, the position invariant is a touchy issue. The size invariant
is a safer thing, because the monkey also was in the same distance from the screen. And in the size invariance, they found for those neurons, those two neurons they tested, an invariance around, you could double the size, you could half the size of the object, roughly.
But this was not tested here, right? Size.
No, size
was not right size. But
so there's, there's no direct contradiction. Like, they probe, if you talk about
probing the position invariance they found was plus minus 2 degrees.
Well, between at least 2, but less than 7 was kind of their summary.
But for very few neurons, and you're not so much controlled by all that. So.
Yeah, but in a gym, I mean, but you cannot even say it's plus minus 1.5.
Right.
Most those neurons,
right.
Yes.
The left bottom.
So there's lots of issues here. You know, is it which neurons? And then there's issues of how are the animals trained, and the issue of eye control. And
these are very plastic systems.
Also, and also, the size of the stimulus.
Yes.
It's all
point 0.6, right. So I think that's my next slide. I had some other quote you talk about. We could jump ahead. So the stimuli were small, and most of those other studies, they were large. And at the end, I have a comparison of the invariance. When it's normalized for size, things come much more back into agreement. So that's one possibility, is that it's kind of an invariance relative to the size of the object. So let me first, this is just a couple of slides. We're almost near the end here. A couple of slides on did position invariance protect these neurons from clutter, which is something else that you want to be invariant to. And I showed you these animals were doing this in what I'm referring to as clutter. But as Tommy pointed out, it's not like real world clutter, some sort of clutter. So what I've showed you is that you could interpret what I've said about some of these neurons, like one of some of the examples I just showed you, is that they almost have small receptive fields and that they're selective here, but not when the target's out there. And some other neurons have to deal with those conditions, okay? So if that's true, you take this kind of naive first order hypothesis, then maybe that's true because, well, the animal has to do this kind of task, right? That's what I was asking him to do in the free viewing, is he needs to identify that even though it's in the midst of a bunch of distractors which are similar, okay? That was the animal's task. And he did this both in free viewing and in control viewing, but it doesn't really matter which. So in control viewing, I showed you they all just came up like this. So maybe this protects the neurons. Well, so the first thing we looked at is responsivity to the best form, that is the best target, without the clutter. So directly at the best position, nominally the center of the field, without the clutter. Okay, so take away the clutter, that's on this axis, versus essentially the response to this stimulus that I've shown up here. Responsivity to the same stimulus and clutter. And if this is true, things should be identical. All these points should fall on this diagonal line of responsivity. You can see they largely do. There isn't a big strong effect of clutter on these neurons. These open circles are significant neurons, either up or down. And there's some trend for being a little less responsive in clutter, which is what most people have reported when you put up more stimuli in the fields of neurons. But overall, this is you have to compare across studies. You say other studies have found generally stronger effects, but it's difficult because they use different clutter and it's not clear. This is about a 10% effect, and usually the effects are more like 50% or something like that. So it's a weak effect if there is an effect. So that's consistent with this kind of hypothesis. And the same is true if you look at, say, form selectivity, although this seems to be a slightly more effective form selectivity. So this is, again, this is an arbitrary measure, but we use best minus worst, and best minus worst in clutter, without clutter and in clutter. And again, they should all be on the diagonal line if it was just a small field like this. But in fact, they're kind of being pushed off this way, suggesting that there's some effect of clutter. And what's happening really is that the response to the worst form in clutter is a little higher here than it is here. The best is about the same in both conditions. So it's when you're putting up this, the neuron's still somehow responding. So this simple hypothesis, it kind of suggests this, but it's probably not completely correct. But so what I wanted you to get from this slide is that in our study, the clutter we used had relatively little effect on these neural responses. And this is consistent with the small amount of position invariance we saw. However, so this suggests that maybe this invariance was built up to help protect these neurons from clutter, or at least did help protect them from clutter. But what this predicts is that, well, I showed you some neurons that were like seemed to have small fields to be well tuned, and some that were kind of invariant, those few that I showed you at the bottom, that you could say, well, their field must be at least this big, because these are the three I tested. So you would make a prediction there that these neurons should be maybe more strongly affected by clutter. This is just a naive field hypothesis prediction. And in fact, that's not true. In fact, the opposite tends to be true, if anything. So what this is a kind of a strange measure, so we don't know if we have to go through all of it. But basically the idea is stronger position tuning this way. That's what I've illustrated with these kind of circles, which is one way of thinking about position tuning as a receptive field. This is stronger position tuning, and this is stronger effect of clutter on form selectivity. So I showed you there's some scatter here. Some neurons are more affected by others. So that's what we're looking at here. The ones that are more affected, that they tend to be more or less position tuned. And in fact, you can see that there's a slight effect for neurons that are more position tuned to also be more affected by clutter. And that the neurons that had these nice invariant properties also seem to also be less affected by clutter. So this is not consistent with a simple receptive field hypothesis. So it's a mixed story that we can't really say what the answer is. Did position tuning protect these neurons from clutter? Well, compared to other studies, they were more protected from clutter and they had stronger position tuning. So in that sense, yes. But if you look closely across neurons in this study, it does not seem to be a strong protective effect here. But we're looking at already weak effects of clutter. Okay. I don't know if that all makes sense.
I mean, receptive fields can dynamically change. I mean, is it possible that instead of having this task, you would have, instead of making the target only the central one, you had also switched the target in the two flanks? So that the animal would always be looking at distractors, but then every now and then you would change the central one and its two flanks to be the target and then ask it to perform the task. Would that have made the position, the receptive field larger? Because your argument is saying, well, I need a purple circle because I was only changing the interior. If you had changed all three instead of the green circle,
So if I had trained the animal in a condition, whenever he got a target, it was in all three positions, and so he could
then maybe.
I don't know. So these are the kind of things that we're thinking about doing: training animals performing in clutter, performing out of clutter. I don't know if I'd do the all three targets at once. It's a little strange, but saying train the animal without clutter and look at invariance, and then train the animal in clutter, and you get an effect of the degree of invariance. Does the training affect the amount of invariance that you see? You're essentially asking that, do the task requirements manipulate the size of, I use this receptive field analogy because it's easy, but I don't really believe it. It's not like there's a wall here. I'm more like the size of the invariant region is what I would say. Do task conditions, training conditions affect it? And we don't know the answer to that, but they probably do. And so that's something that we want to figure out. How do they do it? So I think I'm near the end here. So summarize this. The behavior was position invariant over this relatively small range, but the responses were typically non-invariant. They had some invariance over this range, but it was very small. Comparable selectivity, but again, this is difficult to say. It's still apples and oranges, but different from other studies. Receptive field diameter, if we were going to estimate it, these are only 3 points, but it's about 2 to 3 degrees. So that's kind of the invariance region. And so, or the invariance region would be a little smaller than that. So that's smaller than almost than any other study of invariance, although there have been few and mostly anecdotal. Some of the receptive fields that you saw there did not actually include the center of gaze, at least measured with the four stimuli that we use. That's at odds with most early studies of IT. And I showed you those big receptive fields from Kobataki always include the center of gaze. So this is a little bit different from what has been seen before. Protection from visual clutter, I just went through. There's little overall effect of clutter, so maybe position invariance, lack of position invariance helped protect these neurons from clutter. But the strong position tuning was not correlated with protection from clutter on a neuron-by-neuron basis. So this issue is not yet settled. So then let's just go through the reasons of why maybe we saw this. And we went through some of these came up. Animals learned a specific set of stimuli. they were engaged in a recognition task, whereas in most other studies, except for the Logotheta study, the animals were usually just passively viewing. So maybe some machinery got turned on that changed the size of invariants. Or anesthetized, right. This is, I think, a key difference. The stimuli were very small, 0.6 degrees, and this has come up. Most studies, they were 3 to 5 degrees. The other difference is that during training, we had pretty tight control of retinal stimulation. Those stimuli would come up, we saw with an accuracy of about 0.1 to 0.2 degrees. Whereas in most studies, you have a big window of about a degree where the animal's allowed to move his eyes. And if we had done that with, it could be that that tight control of retinal stimulation actually forced the IT neurons to learn at very specific positions, if you believe there's some plasticity there.
During training
and testing.
Yeah.
But the problem is during training, well, we didn't expect this effect, so the stimuli were actually presented at a range of positions. But most of the time when the stimuli were presented, they were just at those three fixed positions. But whenever they were presented, we knew exactly where they were presented. The clutter issue, maybe the training and clutter, this is what we were just discussing, caused some effect of increased position sensitivity that produced the overall lack of effect of clutter. So let's talk about size. So one, again, we mentioned that maybe it's a stimulus size is different. So this is taking a bunch of studies that I could pull out of the literature that estimated field size or invariance regions in IT. It's difficult to do because everybody has different techniques. And estimate how far out just responses, how do they fall off with distance? And so this is a normalized response. So everybody's starting here at 1 at kind of the center of the field. And so that Tovey study I showed you with the faces, you see responses continue out to like 20 degrees. Remember, they were putting stimuli out here at 11 degrees, still getting very good responses. Whereas other studies found a range of effects here. Whereas we found that we dropped off to about 0.3 when we just moved that 1.5 degrees away. But we had much smaller stimuli. So this is just raw degrees. But if we replot this normalized by the stimulus width, now everybody kind of falls in line. Tovey actually used the largest stimuli of any group here. They were like 13-degree stimuli, and he had the largest region of invariance. So there's some interaction here between stimulus size and stimulus and the amount of invariance that I think you can measure. But this has never been well explored. But there are a lot of hints of it if you look across studies. And it's not clear if this is some feed-forward automatic built-in property of the system, or if it's something about some dynamic feedback, because I'm working with small stimuli or something like that. These are all open issues.
You're saying that if there is somewhere on the way to IT, all the sizes are somehow normalized to some standard representation, then you can move it by about one or two sizes of this standard representation. This is in all of this kind of thing.
I guess, I don't know if I'm saying exactly that. I'm saying the brain compensates its invariance. It compensates its invariance region for the size of the stimuli. Now, whether still in IT. In IT, the invariance depends on the size of the stimulus. That's what this is saying. But it's not clear whether the brain is doing that in an active kind of compensation feedback mechanism, like attention, or it could be a built-in feed-forward property of the network.
I think something like that would come out of the model I described. We can discuss
it. Yes, right. So I think models predict these kind of effects. So, but they, again, this is a cross study, so this isn't.
For example, there are some of the models of invariant recognition assume that there is somewhere on the way, no matter where you see the image, it's somehow transformed into the middle, the center of the case, and that's how the
right, but
position invariance is solved.
So
suggest that maybe also the sign invariance is solved in a similar way.
I don't know if it suggests anything about size. It kind of suggests that mechanism doesn't work as far out when the stimuli are small. That would be what I would say if you had such a mechanism that can reposition. Doesn't position so far for small stimuli. That's another way of saying what's on here.
Do you have a tendency in the data that this position selectivity will be around zero?
Zero, right. That's what's hard about comparing these studies. I mean, I can say where the best point was, but usually people take the fovea and then they measure fall off from that. And so these are my foveal preferring neurons here, center preferring neurons to compare with those. But there isn't.
But in terms of percentage, did you have more center preferred?
Oh, yes. Oh, you're asking my study. So, yes, so more preferred the center than the side positions.
Much
yes.
More.
It's like 60%, 30%. Right.
Jim,
where would the Nikos fall in this?
He didn't have the rates. So these are firing rates. So I didn't quite know how. I should try to put that on there again. So it looked like from that plot we saw that on average those rates would have fallen not much. So they would have been, I think, around up here. You saw that slide that it wasn't having much of an effect of 2 degrees. So he's only 2 degrees, which is here. The rates say 80%, you know, so I think it would still be around here, maybe a little lower. And his stimuli were, I think we did the position invariance for a couple of degrees, yeah, or 2 or 3 degrees, which is what all these were. So he'd still be kind of in this, you know, this is kind of messy, but it's not going to be way off of this. The outliers here are us and Tove, and everybody else is kind of in the middle. And that's kind of apparent there. But again, difficult to compare across studies, but there's some hints of it. The other thing that I think has come up is that, well, we trained, one of the reasons we could have seen this tight position tuning, strong position tuning, is that we trained at these three mostly, very well controlled positions, although the animal did get some experience in here because we didn't expect this, but we trained him at these, with the target always presented on the retina at those three positions. So you could imagine instead of this expected field that we actually built up neuroreceptive fields that were specific for these three trained positions. That's one interpretation of the data. And it's one that we would like to explore. So this can be tested by training in specific locations with similar objects. There are a lot of issues of controls and so forth. We can talk about those afterwards. So this is the last slide. I just want to summarize and say all I'm trying to say is that for me the interesting question is that if we want to understand recognition, we need to understand the representations at each level, especially IT, and how those representations support behavioral invariance. In other words, do they achieve invariance, and if so, how do they achieve invariance? And the current focus is on IT because it's thought to be in a region which has achieved a large degree of invariance to things like position and size. And we found, first of all, I told you some data on free viewing, that virtually the IT representation was virtually unaffected by free viewing. And then in terms of the invariance, we had much less position invariance than we expected. And this has given us several clues as to how behavioral invariance is actually achieved and how it is represented in IT. And it may be a function of size or a function of plasticity, which are those two big things that I mentioned at the end as issues that we need to explore to flesh this out more. But so that's kind of the direction we're going. That's all I had to say. And thank you for your time. I've gone way over. Well, I'm glad we started at 9, or we. Thank you. So we'll maybe hear you a little bit this afternoon still.
So what?
We'll hear some of your.
So yes, it's like so a trio of maybe
like make it
informal,
whatever.
Just
okay.
Show you the model.
There's
some other sensor. Some other sensor. Yes.
Okay.
How did you want to hear? Listen to this. I thought someone might want to see this. It's got the spikes. You can kind of hear it get going before these targets down here. I don't know. It's a little hard to tell. Let's see.
Just one last question. Like, we started from the where and the what, right? So by this result, it's like implicitly the where is where the what is.
Yeah, that hypothesis is kind of overblown. It's not like all what information is stripped away, and that's what this is saying. There's plenty of what information, and that makes the whole binding problem kind of not really a problem, right? It's, and Tommy calls it a straw man, I think. And Shimon Edelman, in his book on representation, I like this client. He says the binding problem is like shooting yourself in the foot and then complaining that it hurts, right? It's like throwing away all the position information and saying I need to get it back together, right? So there's still plenty of information down there. You saw almost as much information about position as there was about a target identity. And that's some of the ideas we're talking about. Could we explore that or show that when we ask the animal to report location and identity, kind of do the binding problem? And Serino's done some work on those. that's actually how, I don't know if you know Ann Serino's papers, but she did tasks where the animal was doing either a where task or a what task, and they recorded in IT and parietal, and found parietal neurons that were selective for identity, and found some position sensitivity in IT, but not nearly what we see here. But so, you know, you gotta, that what where has gotta be taken with a,
yeah, you know. Same story with the caudal area.
Is it there?